Come and throw the rye. Come and throw the rye, poor body, come and throw the rye. She draglet a her petticoatee, come and throw the rye. Oh, Jenny, folks, I'm trying to read Come and Throw the Rye, the poem that this book is loosely based on. So what we're gonna all do is pretend that I read it really, really well, really excellently. And then after the music plays, just like have it in your head that I did a really good job.
All right, and we are coming at you live from Manhattan. We are on a week-long bender, having gotten kicked out of prep school.
Really a weekend-long bender. Really, it's like 2 days, but feels like a week.
I tell you what, it's well, and like as you get older, like your perception of time sort of like everything speeds up, right? So a week feels like what a month used to,
Yeah,
and
like a
so
week
on.
where a decade happens, that kind of thing. Yeah. Well, folks, we didn't want to do this alone. We have a guest on today. We have Aisha Yufari. She is a author and game developer, and she is on here to talk about Catcher with a Rye. So thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
so we when we were talking about you coming on, because we just like messaged, talked about various stuff or whatever, you suggested this book. So without you don't have to go too much into it, but what made you interested in this book? And also just for the listeners, what should they know about you? What's important to know? What's the facts?
Well, my name is Aisha, and I am a game developer, and I've made some independent games too. I've written short stories here and there, podcasts. I supported myself writing freelance for a few years, so I've basically done some of everything. But The Catcher in the Rye is a book that my dad bought me when I was maybe 15. And he was like, "Oh wait, you're 15. You're a teenager now. You have to read The Catcher in the Rye." So he bought me The Catcher in the Rye, and I loved it. I was obsessed with it. I felt exactly like Holden feels. I don't know if I was as much of a. I hope I wasn't as much of a dickhead as Holden, but I probably was. I was 15.
I mean, it could be worse. You could be Ward Stride later, you know?
That's, oh my God,
That's true.
true. Yeah, I think there's worse people in the book to be than Holden. But yeah, I loved it. And I was pretty surprised to find out that most people don't. Like, it seems to be a pretty, like, it's a classic, but it's a pretty widely reviled book for, I think, reasons that we can get into. But it constantly, like, every time there's discourse about The Catcher in the Rye online, I'm like, oh, somebody's wrong on the internet.
And I will say, full disclosure, prior to this, I had not read the book. This is a book I think a lot of people read in high school, given, the high school I went to. It was a, conservative Christian high school. This book would not have flown there.
Yeah, for sure.
All I knew about Catcher in the Rye was just kind of like through the discourse. But I knew very little about this book. And I mean, before we get into it, in full, I'll just say straight up, I had an absolute blast reading this. I thought it was really good. And there's a lot of fun stuff to talk about. But yeah, I am interested to get into that. And also like how a book can go through so many cycles of discussion and understanding and censorship and this and that, and how it can kind of become a thing in and of itself that's completely separated from the original text. I think this is like a good example of one of those, as happens to a lot of classics, but this is one that's like uniquely such, because I don't think there's like a super famous, there's not as many super famous like adaptations or whatever. Like there's certain other classics that people have multiple versions of it in their heads, but in this one, you don't really have like a singular image. It is just the thing and the perception of the thing.
Yeah, no, if J.D. Salinger was successful at one thing, it was creating a work and having it speak for itself, because his works, I don't want to say his works defy adaptation because there have certainly been attempts, but he and his estate and various legal forces have prevented there from being many adaptations, just apart from one that I'll touch on briefly. So you have it, you have it as a relic of its time, certainly, but you also have a certain, I mean, if I were going to describe any work of art as timeless, I would pick this one right away, you know, because it taps into something that I think we all go through when we're growing up. I'm not just throwing that out there. It's very familiar to me, at least. This may be anecdotal, but I feel like it's anecdotal for a lot of people in the same way.
I think it's definitely anecdotal for a certain kind of middle-class American.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that there's a really, even though I guess Holden is pretty rich, but like there's a certain kind of like middle-class malaise in this book that I think is extremely recognizable.
Absolutely. It's a sort of deep angst that is like expressed differently for different generations, but like kind of the inner workings, even if some of the terminology are different, you can kind of see it, like how that those feelings work, how that's interacting. But yeah. I'm like super interested to talk about the author, because I also, you know, knew very little about him. I've dove a little bit into him, but Joss, I think, has kind of the full bio on it. So we'll get into that, and then we'll get into Catcher in the Rye. Joss, what do you have to say about our author, J.D. Salinger?
J.D., yes, for Jerome David Salinger. He was born 1st of January, 1919, just kicking the year off in Manhattan. He was the son of a cheese merchant. He's the grandson of a rabbi. And he started out attending public New York City schools. From 1932, he went to private school at McBurney, where he was active in extracurriculars there. He was on the school newspaper. He was active in the theater department there. He, much like Holden Caulfield in the book, was manager of the fencing team. Caulfield was actually on his way to McBurney as the book starts out.
Yeah, nothing infamously really good at it.
Yeah.
really good at being the manager of the fencing team. I'll just say really quickly, when I was like trying to read about J.D. Salinger in general, one of the first things I saw was in It's Always Sunny meme, the quote where Charlie says, "My father was but a poor cheesemonger." And I thought that was very funny, because he really was.
Yeah.
Well, he was a well-to-do enough cheesemonger to send him to private school, and then to Valley Forge Military Academy over in Wayne, Pennsylvania. And that's where he starts writing. He'd write after Lights Out with a flashlight under the covers. He was literary editor of the yearbook. He was in several clubs. He had a lot going on. Studies, not so much. He was a mediocre student. And he starts at NYU, nevertheless, in 36. On a recommendation from his father, after that, he goes to Vienna to learn the meat importing business. He takes one look at a slaughterhouse. He's disgusted. He says, "I don't want to do this." And he would go on to be a vegetarian for the rest of his life.
That's how it goes in a lot of these cases. Many such cases.
Indeed. Indeed. He goes to Ursinus College, Beartown, in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. It's called Collegeville. Yeah.
Damn. I thought it was called Collegeville.
It's literally called Collegeville. Yeah.
That's cool.
That sounds made up. That sounds like a fake place.
Oh, yeah. I go to college in... Collegeville. Yeah.
It's like, all right, asshole, if you don't want to tell me where you live.
No, that sounds like something Holden Caulfield would say, though. He would be like, he goes to like Collegeville somewhere a billion miles away.
Yeah. You know? 100,000 miles away.
Yeah.
He'd be like, I'm not joking, you know? So he writes for the school newspaper there. He drops out after a single semester. He goes to Columbia School of General Studies, nevertheless, the following year. And it's there that he takes a writing class. And it's during this time that he publishes his first short story in the March-April 1940 issue of Story Magazine. It's called The Young Folks.
Wow. A lot. I know, right? Story Magazine.
Well, this is when stories had just started being invented, you know, so, you know.
That's true.
Other
there
names,
was only Johns. One story magazine. So.
Yes.
And that
yes.
was the word of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. It was just the Bible and nothing else. And that's so this was the second story, actually.
Right. The Catcher in the Rye was the second book.
It's so, true.
Yeah.
Famously.
Yeah.
Very famous schismatic, our J.D. Salinger. So The Young Folks, it's about basically a sterile world populated by petty people, in the words of one critic. Essentially a conversation between a couple of well-to-do, what Holden Caulfield would describe as phonies. Aisha, you're exactly right. It's middle-class, upper-middle-class malaise. You know, he's writing what he knows. He's grown up in fairly well-off circles. He is not impressed by what he sees.
Right.
In 42, he starts dating Una O'Neill, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill, famous playwright, Long Day's Journey into Night, and other things. Mm-hmm. He's 23 at the time. She's 17.
Classic.
Not great.
Yeah, when you get into his dating life, you're like, oh.
Oh, it gets worse.
My
yeah.
dude. Oh, yeah. We were all rooting for you.
Yes, well... it could be worse because he's super into her. She doesn't reciprocate. She dumps him the following year when she's 18 for Charlie Chaplin. Charlie Chaplin is 36 years older than her. Hmm. So I not super in love with the trajectory there.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Don't worry. Yeah. Later in his life, he'll also have some similar age gaps.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah. You know, if you can't beat him, become him, you know?
Yeah.
So by this time, he started submitting to the New Yorker. He's rejected 7 times, including, this killed me, including for a story called I Went to School with Adolf Hitler.
Oh my God.
Was that ever published? Because I am curious what that's about.
He submitted it. I was looking around for it. I think it's lost. If it's not lost, man. It's in some archive somewhere that hasn't been released.
There's a lot of lost. There's a lot of lost Salinger. Like, there's a lot of his stuff that's not published.
I mean, famously, like, you know, to jump ahead a bit, he hated the process of publishing. He considered it intrusive, you know,
it sucks. He's right.
Right. I mean, I think he also, like, I mean, you can even, there's a whole section in The Catcher in the Rye where he gives you his, like, take on fame and how worthless he finds it.
Mm-hmm. It is very autobiographical, and it's a subject, indeed, it's characters that he revisits throughout his career, because in December of that year, the New Yorker publishes Slight Rebellion Off Madison, which is a story about a kid named Holden Caulfield going on a bender in Manhattan. It's basically the middle chapters of Catcher in the Rye. So an earlier version of that story was called Are You Banging Your Head Against a Wall? That was actually accepted a couple of months. Yeah, I've frequently asked myself that question. Mm-hmm. It was actually accepted a couple months prior to Slight Rebellion, but not published because it was considered too depressing. And, you know, neither ultimately did Slight Rebellion get published. It was the 9/11 effect, right? Because Pearl Harbor had just happened. So the story was deemed insufficiently patriotic.
Oh my God.
Yeah, exactly.
He is very anti-patriotic. He does have that one part where he says, I'm glad the atomic bomb was invented because if I go to war, I'm going to ride it and blow up on it. So if he had that in there, and maybe not the atomic bomb part, maybe they were just like, if it had those sentiments, they're like, all right, we can't publish this thing.
Oh yeah, no. And I mean, he has personal experience with that sort of thing. You know, he gets drafted in the spring of 42. He fights on Utah Beach in D-Day, meat grinder, you know, Battle of the Bulge, famous defeat, Battle of Hurricane Forest. And during the Normandy campaign, he meets a war correspondent in Paris by the name of Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
And they really hit it off. Hemingway says, this is a quote, Jesus, he has a hell of a talent. And that's basically the only positive part of the war for him. So from his start as an infantryman, he moves to counterintelligence. He interrogates prisoners of war because he's good at French and German. He helps liberate a Kaufering in April 45, which is a subcamp of Dachau, and infamously like one of the worst subcamps. He told his daughter Margaret later, you never really get the smell of burning flesh out of your nose entirely, no matter how long you live. And it leaves permanent scars on him. His war experience informs these next few stories that he writes. He publishes in Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post, not the New Yorker, by the way, from 1944 to 46. It rejects all of his material. One of his Collier's,
just like me for
now. He has a really,
New Yorker, man. Can I say that?
Yeah. As someone who multiple times they've been like, oh, wait, I like this. And then just like basically ghosted me. Yeah.
You know, not patriotic enough, I imagine.
Yeah,
probably
for sure.
Not.
So he publishes a story in Collier's called I'm Crazy, which is basically the first few chapters of Catcher in the Rye. It's Holden watching the baseball game and talking about that, you know. He does 6 months of denazification duty in liberated Germany, marries a woman there. They move to America in 46. They break up within 8 months. 26 years later, this is just how weird he is with women. He gets a letter from his ex-wife 26 years later while he's with his daughter from his second marriage. He tears it up without reading it.
Wow.
Damn. 26 years.
Christ.
So we don't know what the letter said. We have no idea.
No idea. No idea.
He doesn't either.
That's true. That's a good point.
We do know.
That's something out of a book right there. He's like, and I don't even need to know. Like, just no curiosity. Doesn't care. Wow. 26 years. Still that bitter.
What we do know is that by 1950 rolls around, he's converted to Buddhism, and he's actually giving reading lists on the subject to women that he dates.
Oh my God. Incredible.
And then he switches to Hinduism in 1952, so what does it even matter?
God, he's such a kind of guy.
Yeah, no, he is.
Oh man, he is. I mean, people like him. I've met people like him. Maybe I even been somebody like him. I don't know. His mentor from Columbia agrees to help him publish a collection of short stories. This falls through. They split up. His first real success is called A Perfect Day for Banana Fish. It appears in January 48 in The New Yorker, finally. At this time, they're so impressed that they negotiate from then on a right of first refusal on all his future stories. And he also
I want to just like make this point.
Yeah.
Because like I don't think I highlighted it well enough. At the time, like The New Yorker is one of the only like really good games in town for short stories.
Yes.
Like obviously like the short story market has always been like brutal no matter what era you're writing in. But at the time, like if you want any kind of like national distribution, certainly international distribution on a short story, it's The New Yorker. Like that's where you do it. There is some like niche magazines.
Kind of true.
That's true. No, it's true. It's still the number. It's still like up there at the top. But like there was some niche sci-fi fantasy distributions that like people like H.P. Lovecraft were writing in. And we talked about that in our Lovecraft episode.
Oh,
but, like,
yeah.
For like not like this kind of fiction, that's just kind of where you turned. That or you published it in like a paper that was not getting broad distribution. I know that's reductionist, but it's almost just true, like especially in the late 40s. Anyway, carry on. Sorry about that.
No, you're good. It's I don't know if J.D. Salinger would have thrived more in like a what was it called, like a press collective or something. Whatever community H.P. Lovecraft was writing it. I don't know.
I feel like so much of his life would have been different if it wasn't for the war.
That's true.
Like, I feel like that he, because he was very social before, and he kind of became a complete recluse kind of, not a complete recluse, but I feel like his personality changed a lot after what he went through. Which I find kind of interesting, because like, there is almost a feeling of like when I read that about him and how like his life is like, kind of split into like the before and after of the war, it kind of reminded sort of like even The Catcher in the Rye, how like afterwards he has to like recover somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, and how even like these couple days are like almost like Holden is like in battle. I mean, it's mostly just against himself, but I don't know. It felt very like he was maybe processing his experiences in the war through like a kid getting fucked up and walking around downtown. But
right. I mean, the New York Post, I think it was the New York Post or maybe it was the Times, when they wrote a profile of him in the 90s, straight up said you could set this guy's house on fire and he wouldn't come out. Like that's, you know, what a recluse he was, especially by that point. You're absolutely right. And it's like a thing that there's a dramatic shift at the war, but notably like he becomes a recluse after the war, but he becomes more and more of one as the years pass. Like it's not a thing that happens. It is a marked shift, but it's like a thing that doesn't get better. He gets, I mean, by all accounts worse. Through the years.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
for sure.
Which is, you know, it's not a unfortunately, that's not an uncommon story, people coming home for more.
At this time he's thinking about selling the movie rights to his stuff, right?
That's right.
It's more for the money than for any like artistic inclination. You know, he considers it basically an insurance policy for his second wife at the time and his kid. He sells the rights to a short story of his called hilariously Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut for a nice chunk of change. Yeah, it's like Dickensian, but like with none of the charm, you know, the name.
Mm-hmm.
It's adapted as, you know, My Foolish Heart. It sucks. Critics hate it. It gets nominated for a couple Academy Awards, but forever after, he's like, okay, I'm done with film adaptations of my work.
Mm-hmm.
So on July 16th, 1951, he publishes his only novel, The Catcher in the Rye. And it's a polarizing book, but it's a staggering success. It's reprinted 8 times in its first 2 months. It sells these days about 1 million copies a year. In an interview with a high school paper shortly after, he describes the experience of publishing it as a great relief because, as you know, we were dancing around, it's sort of autobiographical.
Yeah.
It's said to have popularized the phrase screw up, interestingly. It's, of course, been banned several times. A teacher in Tulsa was fired in 1960 for teaching it, later unfired. But, you know, it was taught. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was taught very relatively recently after its publication and, you know, pretty much immediately acquired its reputation for, you know, obscenity, blasphemy, all sorts of things. This was hilarious to me. Like I read about this this one challenge to it that was like a list, you know, of, oh, you know, it's got X amount of the word bastard, X amount of the word Christ sakes, you know, which tells me that the person who mounted this challenge hadn't finished the book, because if she had, she would have said, oh, and by the way, he says fuck several times in the last couple of chapters, and she doesn't say that.
Depending on your publication of it, actually, because the version I read, it was completely dotted out. It was dot.
What? You read an expurgated Catcher in the Rye?
Well, I thought it was, but like, I got worried that I had like missed a bunch of stuff, and I went back and it was like, no, it was just that for some reason, whoever published it. But sorry, I interrupted you, Aisha.
I don't know. I feel like there's so many things in that book that would get it banned now.
Oh, yeah.
We're in the golden age of book banning again, of course. So yes. There's a bunch of stuff. I mean, he talks about gay people, like, disparagingly, mm-hmm. but not something I was expecting. Yeah.
It's disparagingly, but not in the same way, in like this kind of like, I'll get into it. This is my personal theory. He's like a little interested.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. We'll talk about our theories.
Yeah. But no doubt. I mean, I'll just say like my personal experience is like I had multiple teachers. I asked about Catcher in the Rye when I was young, and I had multiple teachers be like, it's nothing but filth. They teach at those liberal public schools, you know.
I feel like you would not catch the Catcher in the Rye in I'm gonna do that a couple times.
It's all good.
In school now, like I didn't read it in school. My dad bought it.
Nor I.
It actually has the second most the ban to teaching rate on it is basically like it is both one of the most banned books and one of the most taught books for high school and young college students.
Yes.
I think it said the only book that like rivals it in being both banned and taught are like Slaughterhouse-Five and Of Mice and Men.
Oh, wow.
Which we talked about Slaughterhouse-Five being one of those banned books on our Slaughterhouse-Five episode. And Kurt Vonnegut basically being like, I got no greater compliment than my book being banned for being un-American.
Right. And those books are like really intense in a way that Catcher in the Rye is not.
It's
emotionally intense, but mm-hmm. not much actually happens in it.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. In one of the earlier short stories that contributed to Catcher in the Rye, you know, Holden Caulfield is described as having like pre-war jitters, but mm-hmm. like, you know, having come out post-war, I don't know that there's, you don't read it and you think, oh yeah, this guy's been to war, right? There's less of that trauma about it and more of something that's been brewing for a while in his head that now he's putting to paper in a more complete form. 1960 to 1982, I believe it's the most censored book in the country, including famously, briefly, Issaquah Washington's high school system banned it in 1978 for being part of an overall communist plot.
Thank God, that's awesome.
Yeah,
well, how you even get there is great.
Oh yeah, you know, you read it and you're like, oh yeah, I from reading Holden Caulfield going on a bender, I understand the labor theory of value now. I know it's. No, I don't know how you get there.
I think for a long time, people just called things that were cool communist. Like if something rocked, it was communist.
Yeah, they're like, that's good, and I don't have a reason to call it bad. Like I mean, like you could do a really abstract, like, well, he complains about like material things being too valuable and people caring about money, but like, come on, plenty of people were doing that.
I think it has like some. It definitely has like some. It's definitely a critique of capitalism in like a way, I think, he hates everything about the modern world and the modern world is capitalist.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. It's just not, it's not really pro something as opposition to it. It's just kind of like, wow, this sucks, you know?
Right. He's not really critiquing it structurally, but you know, it's the tail end of the environment that he grows up in, you know, he's becoming aware of. Yeah. After 1953, where he gives that interview I mentioned, he goes no contact with the high school whose newspaper interviews him. He starts withdrawing from public life. He's friends with like one guy, federal judge Learned Hand, but he sees nobody else regularly. Learned Hand, that's his name. Like if you're like into like legal history of the United States, he's a big name.
What do you know?
Damn, big hand.
Yeah.
Well, you know what they say about learned hands.
Oh my God.
Sorry.
So they're the devil's playthings? I don't know.
Something like that.
He does marry again in 55. He has his daughter, Margaret, that same year, his son, Matt, in 1960. He dabbles in Dianetics, basically pre-Scientology. He meets L. Ron Hubbard. He doesn't pursue that. He divorces.
I mean, if you met L. Ron Hubbard, you probably wouldn't either.
Man, JD Scientologist. Just imagine.
Oh, God.
So he divorces his wife in 1967. She gets custody of the kids. He builds a house across the street and he lives there until his death.
Oh my God.
Which is
so passive aggressive.
That's a power move if I ever of some description. He publishes pretty infrequently from then on, a few short stories, collections thereof. One of which, Franny and Zoe, includes the following on the dust jacket. It is my rather subversive opinion that a writer's feelings of anonymity, obscurity, are the second most valuable property on loan to him during his working years. And that pretty
what
much
is the most valuable?
He doesn't say. It's just,
yeah, that's awesome.
He's like, guess.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
It's my house across the street from my ex-wife. That's my first most valuable.
That's the most valuable property a writer can own, house across from
and
their
only
ex-wife.
I have it.
Well, and he just gives less and less of a fuck as he goes on. Like, Time does a feature on him in 61. He publishes literally one more novella in The New Yorker in 1965. It takes up most of the June issue. Critics savage it. 72, back to his dating life, he gets into a relationship with an 18-year-old, the now journalist Joyce Maynard. They exchange letters. She comes to live with him for 10 months. They split up. He said because she wanted kids and he didn't. She said because he sent her away and had been carrying on similar correspondence, as it happens, with a bunch of young women and had gotten bored of her. One of them, Colleen O'Neill, indeed, 40 years younger than he was, he does end up marrying her. So he continues to write for the rest of his life only for himself. Again, he says publishing is a damned interruption. One of his neighbors reports that Salinger told him he'd completed like 15 novels just totally for himself. So like Kafka, but even more of a douche. Mm-hmm.
We'll get to Kafka one of these days.
Yes, yes, we will. We were talking about this. He gives one last interview. One last interview in June 1980. There's some dispute over the circumstances of it. Betty Epps was the journalist who spoke with him. And however it came to be, she said a couple of years ago, look, I recorded him without his knowledge. I feel terrible about it. She actually wants the tape of his voice to be cremated with her.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's crazy.
Weird.
Yeah. You run into people occasionally who want to know more about you. But, you know, she respects the hell out of his reclusiveness.
Notably, I read that apparently some of his works may still end up being published one day.
Yes.
Very interesting to me.
His wife and his son are the executors of his estate. And they said a couple of years ago, yeah, we've got his stuff. Like, it'll be published eventually, but it's not ready.
Wow. Yeah, they said that in like 2019, too. So that wasn't long ago.
Jeez. Oh, yeah, that was pre-COVID. So,
but I wonder what they're like. I mean, not to be stupid, but like, what are they waiting on exactly? I wonder.
I couldn't tell you.
Are the books just like bad or something? Like, could it be like one of those situations, or is it like just, you know, I don't know. He could be like have left like some weird stipulations. That's also possible. Like, it has to be exactly like Mark Twain has that one book that he said it needs to be like a century after I die that it gets published. Letters from the Earth.
And
it was, and it slaps. Letters from the Earth slaps.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, right? His estate's very, very particular about what gets adapted and what's not. Some Swedish dude wrote what's basically a fan fiction novel called Coming Through the Rye. 60 years later, Coming Through the Rye. It's about like an old man holding Caulfield. It cannot legally be published in the States. It's forbidden in this country until Catcher enters public domain.
Public domain? I want to write my Holden Caulfield fanfic.
I think it's like 75 years from the death of the author or something, which is going to be
a while.
it's going to be a while because he died in 2010, the year after he sued to stop that publication of that book, at the age of 91. So
I'm just imagining it's like climate apocalypse, the 2080s, and we're like finally about to publish our Holden Caulfield fanfic because the last laws being enforced are like rights laws, like copyright
IP law,
laws.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing else is being enforced, but IP law, like Disney will send like Disney shock troops after you. It's like,
The very
finally
Animorphs,
I posted it. Finally, I post my whole
the very last book that gets published in the People's Republic of Hyper Atlanta will be a slash fic of Mickey Mouse and Holden Caulfield.
Thank God. Thank God.
So
OTP.
There's a suggestion among modern critics that his best work mainly owes its quality to the New Yorker editors because his short story collections were released to worse and worse reviews, particularly once he just started writing totally for himself. And I mean, that's pretty much him. You know, after he died, of course, his daughter maintained that he was an abusive presence at home. His son says otherwise. Ultimately, we don't know. You know, we only have hearsay. I mean, I know which way I lean in my assessment of him, but he's somebody who, if only through uncertainty, has more or less maintained unparalleled control over his image and his art, which it's a unique accomplishment. I don't know that I agree with it.
Yeah.
We know anything about his politics? Like, do we know much about what he believed politically?
I know that he's expressed hatred for Reagan and Bush Sr. Right. So
okay.
He's got that going for him.
Mm-hmm. What I was able to find was like some of his criticisms. What he believes is a difficult thing to find. And like, I mean, I found people just claiming stuff, but like cited stuff is a little more hard. But with a guy like that, he comes off to me as just kind of like anti the system, TM, which isn't necessarily pro anything. But I had trouble finding stuff he stood for, at least politically. But it was just wondering if either of y'all had come across anything. Seems like y'all saw about what I saw.
Yeah, not really.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Well, I appreciate that background on him, Joss. It's funny because, like, you know, we talked about a lot of ways in which he was kind of a petty, frustrating guy who was not the best. But man, this is a really fun book. Like, this is a lot of fun. And notably, his only published novel. There's a lot of angst in here. Like you said, it's partially autobiographical, and we'll definitely, you know, talk about that. But it is just this book that is full of this guy's ranting almost. And he's older when he writes, not old, but he's older than this character, this like 16-year-old character when he writes it. But it is this first person, sometimes second person, because he directly addresses the audience, text of this just this kid who is having just a shitty weekend. And just kind of talking about what it means to be a teenager and what it means to be in transition. And I would call it a coming of age novel, and it kind of is, but he doesn't really come of age, you know, like he doesn't, it is just kind of this kid existing and getting through the weekend. And it is in this way, extremely deeply relatable. The one thing I wanted to note before we got into the book, like its plot and its whatever, is some of the effects it's like had culturally, because we talked about its history, but it's had violent reactions to it. In fact, several shootings have been associated with this book. Robert John Bardo, and John Hinckley Jr. apparently also, who tried to assassinate Ronald Reagan, cited this book as an influence on him. And you have there was someone else also. Mark David Chapman.
Yeah.
The guy who killed
John Lennon. Yeah.
John Lennon.
And, and to be clear, there's nothing in this book that I don't think there's anything in this book that incited that, like, particularly.
I mean, if this book makes you want to shoot Ronald Reagan, I mean,
that's fine. No, don't get me wrong.
Among us, like,
critical support, yes.
Yeah.
John Hinckley's music's kind of good, too.
I mean, I definitely, people call Holden a school shooter, which actually really irritates me. Yeah,
I don't get that vibe. He's not a violent person.
He's not violent. He's sad. Like, he's depressed.
Right. I get the inclination that that it having that level of like influence has more to do with the fact that it is just so widely read and there's just so many copies of it out there that it's almost like, the same way, I don't know, like Charles Manson blamed the Beatles for like some of the stuff he did. It's like, because the Beatles were playing on every radio station. It's the song you heard when you thought of a thing. I think it has more to do with that than it does to do with the text of the book itself. Maybe there's some like secret message in there I'm missing, but I genuinely don't think so.
Oh yeah, but you could go through all kind of like manifestos and like, you know, the pasts and personal effects of one shooter or another. You'll find, you know, you'll find books upon books, you know, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you can draw a conclusion from, I mean, you can draw a conclusion from the explicitly racist text, of course, but you know, other than that.
Yeah, for sure. Hmm. Yeah, this book, I guess, like when you start talking about it, I guess the first thing you really have to talk about is just like the style of the, like, just yes. his voice, because the voice is the entire thing mostly. Like,
agreed.
And it's really hard to describe. Like, you have to read the book to really get like how this book sounds, but it sounds like a kid kind of talking to you, sort of maybe somebody who's had a lot of caffeine, sort of talking to you.
It's very like just venting to somebody over like a glass top table on your parents' deck out back at 1 a.m. sort of thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it's like, I'll even read the first few sentences here because it opens up like this. Chapter one. If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it. If you want to know the truth in the first place, that stuff bores me. And the second place, my parents would have had about 2 hemorrhages apiece if I told anything pretty personal about them. They're quite touchy about anything like that, especially my father. They're nice and all. I'm not saying that, but they're also touchy as hell. Besides, I'm not going to tell you my whole goddamn autobiography or anything. I'll just tell you about this madman stuff that happened to me around last Christmas, just before I got pretty run down and had to come out here and take it easy. And it goes on for a while before that even thing ends. He just talks like that, and he will completely go on these diatribes way too just off on anything, and he talks like that at you the whole book. It's not written to a specific person aside from the reader, but he will say you, like, he'll say like, you should have seen it all the time and things like that. But and that is his way of talking,
but it's weirdly, it's not annoying.
Like, I agree.
No,
I find him delightful. I just am like, oh, he's so cute.
Which makes me, I mean, I don't understand the hate for it, because I've read several, I don't know if John Green is guilty of this or not, but I've read several young adult fiction novels that specifically call out Catcher in the Wild, Catcher in the Rye, like, oh, it's so annoying, oh, Holden Caulfield just whines all the time, and I'm like, he's gone through some serious shit, like, yeah. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, if you're not really paying attention to this book, I guess it's kind of easy to miss all the shit that he's been through, because he really brushes it off. Yeah. He'll just sort of mention it a little bit and then be like, well, anyway, you know, that's the time that my little brother died, and then I was so upset that I punched a wall and I broke my hand and I had to stay in the hospital, but it was fine, it didn't matter, whatever. And then he just keeps going, and you can just, you kind of... Like, he's a very unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. So if you're not paying attention, you might just believe everything he says, which is a mistake.
Absolutely.
Well, and again, he throws it out right there. You know, my parents don't want anything like personal said about them. You know, they're very touchy. You know, he's in an environment where you kind of have to be an unreliable narrator about what you're going through.
Exactly.
If you wanted a narrator, you know, people say I'm literally neurodivergent and a minor. It's Holden Caulfield.
He literally is neurodivergent and a minor. And minor. He's 16, which I forgot about. In my head, I don't know why I was like, he was in college, but no, he's not. He's 16 in prep school.
Yeah, he doesn't live at home, which is, I think, maybe where that like distinction comes. And he refers to like remembering going to school back like when he lived with his parents. But he's a 16.
He talks like he's like 35. Yeah. But he's 16.
I think some of that is just the era in which it was written, and just some of the lingo that's used here is just, you know, 40s and 50s lingo.
What he has the luxury to go around and do, you know,
like he's got a lot of money.
Yeah, you know, he's got walking around money. Because
he said, what was it? His grandmother sends him. Yeah, his grandmother sends him money like 4 times a year on accident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, calls money dough basically the whole time.
Yeah, which is cool.
What is it? It starts. He's just been kicked out of his like 4th prep school or something like that. So he's a terrible student, much like J.D. Salinger. Mm-hmm. Although you can tell he's very smart.
Yeah. He calls himself, he says, I like to read a lot, but I, no, he I'm, says, I'm illiterate, quite illiterate,
but I read a lot.
Yeah, oh, quite illiterate, but I read a lot. That's and I like me. That. No, I wrote down, one of my first notes is, he's illiterate, but he reads a lot. Bro is just talking. Like, he just says stuff. And and there is meaning behind what he's saying, but he's talking at you a mile a minute here, which is very meaningful. But it's notable, his class status is, you know, upper middle class. Like, his family is very quite well to do. His dad's a lawyer.
They have a fancy apartment in downtown Manhattan.
Yeah, yes. They have a maid. They have a maid, a fancy apartment. They can afford to put him in four different schools that they're definitely paying for him to be in. And he's able to not really be that financially worried. Like, his money that he's able to spend to just like live is just his gift money, which is quite a bit of money that he's just getting as gifts. So like he is coming from that upper middle class, that like that comfortable, you know, New York, that comfortable New York lawyer, like family, highly educated family. His brother, his older brother writes movies in Hollywood. You know, and so that's like he lives in that world. And so that's also very important to understanding this. This isn't a guy that's like, you know, he's not crazy because of some kind of class exploitation in the same way.
Right.
He's not really had to work particularly hard. In fact, to some degree, he dreams of just like going off and having a job and being normal. But he also, I don't think, is super aware of his class status. But that's because this is a, not because the book isn't aware of it, but because he is personally like stuck in his own perspective.
Right. And he's only been around a bunch of other rich boys at schools who he hates most of them.
Yeah. And yeah, they sound like they suck.
Yeah. Most of them are terrible.
Yeah. It's very interesting how he describes people, Holden, because he's very fair when he describes them. He's like, he'll describe someone and he'd be like, but he was all right. Like, he was an okay guy. And then he'll talk about him and he's like, well, he kind of did this thing. You know, actually, I hate that, fucking hate that guy. And he'll kind of just get there. But he's very like, he's not very judgy, Holden. He's quite like, you know, he gives you a chance.
He does judge people, but he's also like, yeah, I hate that guy, but we hang out because he's like kind of witty though. Like he's maybe a little too witty, but he's whatever.
Yeah.
Or like he'll be talking about his friend and he'll be like, yeah, he thinks he's so hot. He's kind of hot though.
Yeah, he's like, I kind of do. He's like, sometimes I like to just come to the bathroom and watch him talk, which I was like, wow. Okay, Holden.
He's got more smoke for institutions than he does for like individuals generally. Like, it's really fun dig at school spirit and how overblown it is here in this first chapter. Cause I mean, right here, it was the Saturday of the football game with Saxon Hall. The game with Saxon Hall was supposed to be a very big deal around Pensy. It was the last game of the year and you were supposed to commit suicide or something if old Pensy didn't win. So I went to Riverwood over in Sandy Springs, and my junior year homecoming game ended up being the first one that we won in like 18 years. People were crying and shit. I wasn't there. I was home reading a trivia book or some shit because I didn't care about it. But like people do seriously get worked up over this stuff. And so there is a certain what's the word that I'm looking for? It's authentic.
I'll also say, as someone who went to a school that was known as a football school and always won at football, when you always win, people stop caring. So don't be too good, because then it sucks.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there. But yeah, he goes to this school. He like lives, he lives with these guys here, and they're guys who are like characters sort of at the beginning, that they move on. You know, he's really the only character that's here the entire time is him. There's like this rotating cast of people he's interacting with.
Yeah, even people he just calls on the phone and talks to for like two pages show up. Like that girl he tries to like have a cocktail with him and she's like, no, thank you. It's like 2 a.m. Are you 12? Awesome. Like,
yeah. He's got the two suite mates, well, the roommate and the suite mate, and there's like the two types of guys at this institution. The one is
the hot guy and the nerd.
Yeah. The hot guy and the nerd. And it's like the nerd who's like not the nice nerd. Like he's just like kind of, I don't know. It's like the guy who would play League of Legends for 12 hours a day. That kind of guy. Yeah. He
or Astley or whatever his name is.
I thought it was Ackley. Am I wrong?
Ackley.
It's Ackley. Yeah.
I don't know about old Ackley. Yeah.
Yeah. He's always popping his zits. And
I mean, you know what they say about old Astley. He's never going to give you up.
Right. God. Joss, you're on notice for this episode. Ackley says he's like always popping zits, and he's like basically like, I don't know, if this was written today, he would be like the incel character. Like that's kind of what his deal is. And then but he also feels protective of Ackley, notably. And then you have Stradlater, is that how you say it? Stradlater?
Ward Stradlater.
Who is like the jacked hot roommate who is, you know, always going on dates. And you know,
Right, and he's going on a date with a girl that Holden knows.
That's
and
important.
Holden gets really mad about it.
And he doesn't even know the girl's name. Her name is Jane, but he's like, Jane, something, whatever, I don't know. And he's like, I've seen how he does on dates. And then it's like a really dark moment where he's like, yeah, where they're always like, no, no. And he's like, yes, yes. And I'm like, oh holy shit.
Yeah, I mean, Holden also says, like, Holden has this habit of like, being uncomfortable with things that he thinks that are like, but that everybody else does. So he's like, you know, I shouldn't be. He's like, you know, my problem, the reason that I haven't had sex with a girl yet is when they tell me to stop, I do. I probably shouldn't, but, and I'm like,
he's just aware enough to be like, maybe most of the people around me are kind of dicks, like, they're not really punished for it. Like,
but he like sees a lot of things as bad, right? Mm-hmm. But then it's like just becomes to him because he's 16, right? It's like, oh, it must be because everything sucks, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, oh, wow, like, people are phonies and there's cliques at school and I'm not doing good in school. It must be because, phony and depressed are the two most used words in this novel. And it's like, and he's like, it must be because the entire world is terrible, right? And and then the next sentence, he'll see a girl that's hot and he'll be like, this is the greatest day of my entire life.
Yeah, he meets that hot like older woman on the train and he's like having the best time.
But to make sure, like, you know, for those who haven't read the book, which, by the way, I do, it's actually not a hard read, but you know, we tend to on our episodes say read the book, don't read the book, or you know, in the middle, this is a book where I'd say go for it, read it.
Yeah, definitely read the book.
It's online for free in multiple places. It's you know, whatever, I read it in like 4 hours. Mm-hmm. But sorry, to go back to the point though, like, plot wise, you know, he's leaving this school, and he feels, you know, he feels weird about it. And most of this book is, it's not like intensely plot heavy, because a lot of it is his own like just sort of side diatribes. So like, in to just say it quickly, it would be like, oh, he's here, he's leaving the school, he tries to write a essay for his roommate, he leaves the school, and he like just goes on a bender around New York. But like, it's in the details that matters.
An essay for his roommate that channels some really deep trauma.
Right. And that's what I wanted to point out. Well, because talk about that.
Yeah. Allie is his name, right? Allie is the brother. Mm-hmm. And he's died of, it's not cancer. It's some other disease that I forget, but he was like 10 when he died, and
he died of leukemia.
Yes, yeah, and that shadow hangs over him for the rest of the. I mean, Jacob, you and I were talking about it before. There's a part early on where Holden is walking across the street to talk to a teacher of his that he kind of likes. Because the one subject he didn't fail was English. I mean, it shows. The one subject he didn't fail was English, right? And he's walking across the street and he says, yeah, you know, you're walking across the street in the middle of winter and I kind of felt like I was disappearing. So that kind of hits different because, you know, you're walking across the street, it's winter. There's just some way, and this is anecdotal, that sound kind of carries more in the cold air. Like, it's just kind of stiller. You can hear stuff from further off. And it feels especially empty when you're in, like, the middle of a highway on the countryside, But that imagery comes back in the latter half of the book, where he's walking across the street, he feels like he's disappearing, and he actually prays to his younger brother not to let him disappear.
Right, when he's real sick, like, he's toward the end, he's like running a fever because he hasn't slept and he's been drinking so much.
Yes, yes. And so there's that sense of, oh, you know, not only does he feel like he's disappearing because, you know, environmentally, but he's in the middle of town and he feels this way. So, like, he's got, to me anyway, he's got the kind of suicidal ideation at that point where you're like, you know, I wouldn't actively kill myself, but I wouldn't mind if I stepped in this road and a car hit me, you know?
Yeah.
So it's he returns to these emotional beats with increasingly increasingly, I mean, as you get toward the end of the book, unresolved trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, he's gotten kicked out of school. He's just like, was going to go in a fencing tournament, but he left all of the swords and shit on the subway. So they couldn't compete and everybody's mad at him. And he like is mad at himself and he gets into a taxi because he's like, I'll just leave now. I won't wait to like get kicked out. I'll just leave now. I'll just go stay in a hotel for a couple of days and then I'll go home. Whatever.
Yeah, you can't fire me. I quit. Kind of.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So he gets into a taxi. And I think one of the scenes I think about all the time is he gets these like hyper, I don't know, they're part of it. He gets like these little hyper fixations. There are things that he really does care about. Like he wants to know about the ducks. Where do the ducks go in the winter? He worries about it. The ducks in Central Park, because it's cold and the fountain's not running and it freezes. Where do the ducks go? Does a man come and put them in a truck and take them to the zoo? And he asks that taxi cab driver, old Horowitz, about it. And they have a conversation about it. And the guy gets really, he's like, he gets mad at him about it or something.
I love the ducks. I love that recurring theme. You know, sorry, were you?
No, I just, he kind of like, he gets worried about, he is worried about small things and children. Yeah. Like he has a lot of like protective urges, I think. Yeah. Well, he doesn't really know how to like process.
Well, and as well. Oh yeah, I mean, he loves his little sister to death. You know,
yeah,
like the one like innocent person left in his life who was not really exposed to, you know, the way that the world is fucked up. I'm glad that you mentioned the taxi driver, because the taxi driver doesn't give a shit about the ducks. He gives a shit about the fish.
Right, the fish.
Mm-hmm. Which interests me, because like the ducks can leave, the fish can't.
You know, this is, you know, presumably early 1950s, right?
Yes. Like,
how long have trucks even been around? And he's just like, the cycle of life includes trucks coming to take the way that it's just very funny. It's just like, it's just a very like silly thing to think of. And it's like one of those things where it's like, this kid would love Google, right? And he's like, and it's one of those things where you're like kind of sitting somewhere and you're like, I'm 95% sure I know this.
Have you seen?
What if not? What if a truck does come though? What if it does though?
Also interesting how he's really concerned about this thing. And this other person is like, no, that thing that you're worried about doesn't matter.
Yeah, and he gets
this
like mad
about other it. Thing yeah. matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel
fish.
Like this happens to Holden a lot.
Yes.
Like Holden really cares about certain things, but everybody tells him that the things he cares about don't matter, or they're stupid, or he doesn't care about the right things. Like even
life
the
is
people...
a game that one plays by the rules.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's like, I know, sir, I know that's true. Mm-hmm. Like, so like various, like he does, I think he has a lot of like men he looks up to, but he can't really, like, he doesn't ever really effectively, I think, express himself to anybody in this book.
Yes.
There is multiple times he says the trouble with intellectual people is they don't want to have a good conversation when you want to have a good conversation.
Right.
He'll you know, he'll call up his friend and be like, I want to talk intellectual with you, and he doesn't want to. And then there'll be other time where someone tries to talk deep and he's like, I'm actually so sleepy right now.
Right. Or that guy he talks, he's like, that guy, he loves this guy, he talks about sex all the time. All he wants to do is talk about sex. And then he hangs out with the guy and all Holden does is talk about sex, and the guy does not want to talk to him about sex.
No, it's like, it can't be stressed enough that like Holden is an annoying little shit, and in a very endearing way, but he is an annoying little shit. Like, and also like something we didn't note yet. And because, and again, this isn't a very plot heavy book, but like one key character trait of his is that he lies a lot. He's not a particularly good liar. He just makes stuff up in a very 16-year-old way. I'm just going to right now say something I did when I was 16 years old as an example. When I was 16, and this is a socialist shelf exclusive here. No one's ever heard this one before.
Oh, damn.
But it's not that deep. But there was a guy I thought was like really, I was really quite interested in, quite infatuated with. And he was talking about Sherlock, the TV show. And I was like, yeah, I can do that. I was 16. I was like, what? I was like, I can basically have like Sherlock powers. I just like said it. I sounded really smart. I think it was 15. And I was like, yeah, I can basically like do the thing where I can like look and like deduce things. And he was like, no, you can't. And I realized like very obviously I couldn't do that. And I was like, oh, I was kidding. But I was dead serious. And I remember, and I thought of that. And I hadn't thought of that in years, but I remember it now. Because I was like, oh, that's like such a Holden Caulfield thing to do. To be like, oh, yeah, no, I can do this. And they're like, what? And then you realize your thing was dumb and saying whatever. But I remember me being a 15-year-old just straight up lying and saying I have the abilities of the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock Holmes. And then just being like, that was a dumb lie. I was kidding, actually. Ha ha. And it's like very funny, but it's like that's just how 15, 16-year-olds talk and act. But
he also likes to make stuff up. Like when he gets beat, like when that pimp punches him and mm-hmm. he like pretends that he's a secret agent who's like been shot and is like bleeding and he's like, oh, I'm gonna go fall down the elevator shaft or something like that.
Which is funny because it's as if he didn't just get, you know, attacked by a pimp, as if that's not interesting in it right. of itself. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just plot wise to kind of get where we're at. Holden has moved into New York City now. He has gotten away after a brief foray, you know, on the bus where he just lies to a random woman about her son. And, you know, just worrying
your
about the dog.
Your son's awesome. Everyone yeah. loves him. Even
Which
though
is
he's
a great
like,
lie.
Yeah.
Great lie her, to tell.
He was like, her son's a fucking dick, but I told her he was great.
Yeah, exactly. After that, he gets to this hotel, this just like really shady hotel that, you know, basically... If it seems to him that everyone there is just like there to hook up or to like meet with prostitutes or to just like, you know, be there for whatever reason he's there. Like he looks out the window and he sees like a guy dressing up in lingerie. He sees a couple and the woman is spitting into the guy's mouth and she spits back and they spit back and forth.
Yeah, he calls them the perverts.
Spitting back and forth.
He calls
forever.
Them the perverts, but then he's like watching and he's like, that's yeah. kind of cool, actually. I like yeah. that, you know? And he like gets drunk at or tries to get drunk and fails to at the bar downstairs and like meets some women that are
because he's still too young to drink even in like 1950.
Yeah,
right,
he's too
but
young to drink.
He looks... older because he's tall and has gray hair, like he's yeah. real tall and he says
he looks older but he gets denied a lot
yeah
because well, he you know by his own admission he acts like he's 13.
That's true.
Yeah,
but you are like, right, he does look older. But then that's where he's like just I mean like you know for the I don't know what it's he says he's feeling very sexy and by that he means he's like horny like he's,
right he uses mm-hmm. the word sexy to mean horny which is really funny. He's like mm-hmm. he's like what does he say? He's like, I'm not saying I'm oversexed or anything, but I am pretty sexy.
Yeah, I am pretty sexy. Like the first time he uses the term I know of is when he's talking about the woman he sees on the train. He says she was around 40 or 45, I guess, but she was very good looking. Women kill me. They really do. I don't mean I'm oversexed or anything like that, although I am quite sexy. I just like them. I mean, they're always leaving their goddamn bags out in the middle of the aisle. And like, that's the quote. That's the paragraph.
Yeah. I love when he says things kill him. He's like, that kills me.
Mm-hmm. And then yeah he has the actually I do want to read one more quote here and that's from when he's in the hotel because like you know odd as it is like this like his infatuation with sex is like very central to the novel. It's very central like his fact that he's a virgin and he's a virgin because he you know isn't a sexual predator basically mm-hmm. like right. that's what he says. He's like if only I'd been willing to like have sex with women that didn't want me to have sex with them, I wouldn't be a virgin anymore. Which is
and
like
he doesn't cop to it right away. Like he says,
no, yeah, he lies.
Yeah, yeah, earlier in the book, he's like, yeah, yeah, no, I've you know been around the block, and then later he's like, yeah, I know, I'm totally a virgin. If you want to know the truth,
yeah, but I want to read this quote because it's just like I think it's important to understanding his psyche, and this is when he's staring out that window, and this is shortly before and I know there's a lot we have to say on this, but shortly before he hires a prostitute. He says, and this is when he's like looking at the girl, getting like water squirted on her face, after squirting back and forth. And he says, the trouble was that kind of junk is sort of fascinating to watch, even if you don't want it to be. For instance, that girl that was getting water squirted all over her face, she was pretty good looking. I mean, that's my trouble. In my mind, I'm probably the biggest sex maniac you ever saw. Sometimes I can think of very crummy stuff I wouldn't mind doing if the opportunity came up. I can even see how it might be quite a lot of fun in a crummy way. And if you were both sort of drunk and all, to get a girl and squirt water or something all over each other's face. The thing is, though, I don't like the idea. It stinks, if you analyze it. I think if you don't really like a girl, you shouldn't horse around with her at all. And if you do like her, then you're supposed to like her face. And if you do like her face, you ought to be careful about doing crummy stuff to it, like squirting water all over it. It's really too bad that so much crummy stuff is a lot of fun sometimes. Girls aren't too much help either. When you start trying not to get too crummy, when you start trying not to spoil anything real good. I knew this one girl a couple of years ago that was even crummier than I was. Boy, was she crummy. We had a lot of fun, though, for a while, in a crummy way. Sex is something I really don't understand too hot. You never know where the hell you are. I keep making up these sex rules for myself and then I break them right away. Last year I made a rule that I was going to quit horsing around with girls that deep down gave me a pain in the ass. I broke it though in the same week I made it, the same night as a matter of fact. I spent the whole week necking with a terrible phony named Anne Louise Sherman. Sex is something I just don't understand. I swear to God I don't. And like that's just him distilled. And like I deserve it's an award really for not relatable. Breaking. It's like, he's just like me for real.
He's just like all the things he said. I was like, yeah, I feel you.
Feel it, especially I got a 16-year-old. Yeah.
Somebody, I mean, one day somebody will tell Holden about squirting water on each other kink, and he can do it consensually with a girl who's into it.
Yeah, he'll understand that there's like there's more to sex than girls who say no and like
exactly.
And then also, but like, and he's confused about like he'll understand there's more dynamic than that, but he's like confused and out of it or whatever. But yeah, it's so that's like that very humorous scene though. Then going into like this scene where this bellhop, like he meets his bellhop and hires a prostitute, and then I know y'all both almost had some stuff accident. To say about it. Almost by accident,
like
yeah,
very, very passively.
He kind of gets like I don't want to say pressured into it, but like it's
I would say a little bit pressured into it.
Yeah,
yeah, you know,
he's sold on it, and then he's like, okay, like five bucks a throw, as he puts it, 10 bucks for the night, 15 till noon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he's like, okay. Like you get the sense that he doesn't really know what he wants. Cause like he knows what it means to hire this person for this amount of time, but he just wants to talk to her as it happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He wants to talk to her first, at least. Cause he just said that he doesn't really like messing around with girls that he doesn't like. Like he thinks he doesn't really like see the point to it, even though he does it. But like, I don't know. And then the whole scene, because she's very clearly doesn't want to be there either. And he like notices how young she is. And I mean, he's really young too, but and just like I like the comment of her taking her dress off and then asking him to hang it up so it doesn't get wrinkled. And he looks at her dress hanging there, and it made me so depressed that I just asked her to leave.
Yeah. And even pays her, you know, he pays her.
But not enough, as it happens.
Yeah. Well,
he thinks it is.
He gets scammed.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Just straight up, like, what do y'all think about, like, I don't know, the fact that he hires this prostitute and then he wants to talk to her and then she's annoyed with him and then he, you know, sends her away. I don't know. What does that? Trying to think, because like it's kind of emblematic of like how confused he is. But it's also just this situation of like, I think he's just not ready to partake in these things that he knows are like tainted, like things that are good, right? Good things like sex that have been tainted by society, as you might call it, by things like prostitution. Good things that he likes, like, you know, art and stuff that have been tainted by, you know, commercialization. There are good things that he enjoys, right? Mm-hmm. That the adult world, as he understands it, has ruined, and in his own perception. And he's kind of just sees this all as this jumble. He almost sees it as like, I don't know, a cliff you could fall off into this adult world. We'll get into that. But I don't know. Do you have any other thoughts on this? Because this scene sticks out to me, even though it's like message is quite clear. It's not really a complicated scene, but it's something that like bears, I don't know, thinking about.
I do know that this scene is a scene that gets brought up a lot as to why that this is a bad book and Holden is a bad guy, which I think is very strange, because if you actually read the scene, Holden doesn't come off badly in this scene. Yeah. He comes off like a gentleman. He usually does. He's a very nice person to people's faces all the time. Almost entirely. He tells that one girl she pisses him off, but that's like the only time. He's a very gentle person.
Mm-hmm. He's typically pretty polite.
So I think it's just like the grapevine of 16-year-old hires a prostitute.
Right. And that sounds bad. And it is bad. The book's not, you know.
Yeah.
The book's not like, oh, this is good and this is cool that this happened. But it's like, this is the situation he stumbled into. And it's very gross and weird. And it lands him in a grosser and a weirder situation because he gets the shit beat out of him by the pimp, by this bellhop.
Yeah.
Who's running the scam.
Right.
He's horny and he doesn't quite know why. He hasn't figured out his relationship with sex. And what does he do? He jumps into the sex trade with both feet, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, no, thank you. And then he gets beaten up and then he pretends to have gotten assassinated or something and pretends to fall down an elevator shaft, because that's what you do.
Yeah, as one does. I was gonna say like that's such a 16-year-old thing to do, but like honestly, you know, even now it's like you stub your toe, and it's like what would have been a cooler way to stub my toe?
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What if I was James Bond and stubbed my toe?
Right. That would how would I do it then? And you know, he's very this quirky guy, and his quirks feel very real, like those things. And he's like, I swear I'm a madman. You know, he'll say that all the time, like, I swear I'm a madman. I swear I'm crazy. You would hate to be in my brain. It's very much
you
like
don't
that
understand
meme.
My twisted mind.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's very much that meme. It's very much the like redrawing Hamburger Helper to have like vampire teeth and saying, you can't understand my twisted mind. And it's like, no, actually, we all understand your twisted mind, Holden. But it's the experience of being 16. And being like, no one else has ever felt like this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it gets it so well.
I also think to a certain extent, like a lot of it is teen angst, and it's feeling like a lot of people, everybody feels like this when they're young. But I think also that like, there is a certain like clear eyedness that you have when you're young, when you haven't really accepted the world as it is. Where you can sort of see the cracks in everything of where it like comes together, the way that like you learn to just, you know, look away from things that bother you or things that you don't think are good. And I really like the way that Holden sees the world. Like it's very, I don't think it's very fun for him because he's depressed. Like he's having a bad time, but I remember feeling like that.
Yeah.
And I remember that like because he's really alienated by like modern life, by heterosexual modern life too. He talks about how like the idea of getting married and living in a white picket fence, getting a goddamn Cadillac. Like he kind of keeps hitting on these sort of like heterosexual life markers that he finds very alienating. And he can imagine having a wife, but in this very sort of like strange, like almost fairy tale way that he makes up. And I don't know, I felt that way too. And I escaped from it through like being a writer and being gay. So I'm hoping for these things for Holden when he grows up.
Absolutely.
He could be a writer, he could be gay.
Yeah.
It's weird, argue. Like his relationship with because he doesn't know what he wants to do with himself, but like his relationship with like fantasizing about it is like, I mean, there's a part toward the end where he's like, hey, you know, you want to get married and we'll go to a cabin in the woods. Like we don't even have to talk to each other at all. You know, like if we have kids, you know, like, you know, we'll, you know, teach them to read and whatnot, but you know, no talking at all. He has a vague sense of, you know, like I go to school and like there are a lot of rich assholes there. Like the more rich people there are, the more crooks there are, you know, like all those Ivy League bastards look alike. You know, he knows just enough about his class position to, you know, critique it without really interrogating it.
When he has nicer bags than another kid that he's rooming with, he just remembers it because this is another one of his diatribes, right?
Class tension.
He's just like, oh, this kid doesn't have good bags, he probably feels bad about that, I'm gonna hide them. And then the kid's like, no, I'm gonna put him up and pretend to be rich. And then he's like, well, that sucks, I hate that I have good bags. And also, but then he also was like, it's stupid when you have bad bags, that bothers me too. And he doesn't have you know, to be clear, he doesn't have any, I was going to say he doesn't have it all figured out. He doesn't have any of it figured out, but he is this 16-year-old and he's always like fantasizing about running away, like to somewhere, like, oh, I'm going to go up and I'm going to get a job pretending to be mute and deaf and working at a gas station. Oh, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to just like disappear to here, or I'm just going to run off with all this money and live as long as I can in the woods. And like, that's also a very like teenage thing. Like that's a very like, and it doesn't come from like, you know, it's funny, you know, it's funny. And like, it's not funny because it comes from something real. It's because that is like a thing. Like I remember being a teenager and being like, oh, well, the problem is like everything around me. And if I could just like somehow remove myself to some purer state or something somewhere better, then everything would be better. And to some extent, that's true because he has real critiques of around him.
He does.
But to some extent, he also just has this stuff inside of him. He has, you know, seeing, you know, he has his brother dying. He has the fact that like there was a student he was friends with that died in a horrible accident.
Who like jumped out a window. Yeah. Like somebody after, who was bullied.
Because he says at one point, I don't remember the student's name, which is a tragedy, but like he what does he say? He's like, yeah, you know, six guys took him into a room, and he doesn't even mention what they did to him.
He says, I wouldn't even tell you what they did, and the kids jumped out to escape.
He says, like, it's...
He has these horrible experiences. Sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead, Josh.
Well, yeah, no, we're led to believe, like, it sounds... I mean, it sounds like a gang rape or something, just something that's too horrible for even him to say, right? Mm-hmm. And he's surrounded by this stuff. Like, I mean, right here, you know, he's like, yeah, you know, like, I'm at a football game and there's this guy telling his date, like, while he's feeling her up, about this roommate of his who swallowed a whole bottle of aspirin and he killed himself. And, like, imagine giving somebody a feel and telling them about a guy committing suicide at the same time, which, yeah. I mean, in fairness, that's the sort of thing that Holden Caulfield would do.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
Because that's the thing, right? He's surrounded by all sorts of horrible shit that's there, but for the grace of God go I, you know? Yeah. And so mm-hmm. it makes complete sense that he wants to escape it.
Yeah. I think also he has this girl that he keeps talking about, Jane Gallagher. Yes. He never speaks to her in the book. He never gets her on the phone. Mm-hmm. She's kind of like this person that he holds up as like this almost an ideal. Because they never dated or anything. Like, they kind of got close a couple times.
Yeah, if you would tell tell the listeners, like, who is this character, Jane? And, like,
Jane Gallagher is a girl from, I think he grew up next to, where her parents' dogs used to get into Holden's yard and tear it up, and their parents, like, would fight
about it. Yeah, classic meet-cute.
He ran into it at their club, like, I assume, like, social club. Country club or something, and they made friends, and he's like, I don't care, your dog can shit in my yard alone, whatever. So they made friends, and he really liked her, and she had an abusive stepdad, I think was what, that he was very protective of her, and he was trying to figure out like what was going on, but she would never tell him. And he kind of has this sort of very wistful like picture of her in his head. Mm-hmm. That he keeps referring back to, and she's the only person he ever really mentions that we don't really hear from.
Notably, like, they, you know, they weren't together, but they did like hold hands a lot. And he says, we held hands, and it wasn't like bad holding hands, like it wasn't like sweaty or whatever.
Yeah.
Or
he was like, she was great around at holding your hand. Like,
yeah. And he said, and she did this thing one time where she touched the back of my neck, and that was just crazy, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, and he's going nuts about it. And like, it's one of those, like, he's very excited. And he's like, and we almost kissed and then we didn't, you know, and it's, and, you know, one of the, you know, starting parts of this book, starting parts of like him being very angry is his roommate having gone on a date with her. And we have no idea how the date went. And we, you know, he never actually gets in contact with her and she never shows up, which, you know, I just kind of expected her showing up would be the end or somewhere towards the end. And that never happens. She remains this, I mean, literally girl next door idea in his head. And you could say, oh yeah, next week they hung out. And like, yeah, maybe, I don't know. Right. That's not really the point, but within the confines of this story, you know, she never shows up. She just exists as this ideal that he can kind of think of. This example of purity, this example of like, it's weird to call her like an example of a childhood that he's leaving behind, because that's not exactly true either. I mean,
I think his little sister fills that role pretty neatly.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's, you know, again, the kid that he spends half the book walking around with this record that he buys for her because he knows for a fact that she'll like it, right? Yeah. And he spends a couple of chapters, you know, he sneaks into his own home at one point and he wakes his sister up and just spends a few chapters like talking about, oh yeah, you know, I got kicked out of school and, you know, this, that, the other. And at one point she offers to like run away with him, mm-hmm. and just, you know, do whatever he's doing. And he's like, no, you know, you gotta stay behind and live your life and not follow me into, you know, whatever nonsense I get up to. Like, it's that thing of like, his sister is going to be where he is eventually and figure out what's wrong with the world. And he doesn't want that for her, but he also knows that it's inevitable.
Right.
Which busts him up.
And I think that she's also the one who he expresses his one sort of vision of the future that he likes, where she asks him, isn't there anything you want to do? And he says, what is he refers to that poem that was read so beautifully in the beginning.
Yes,
perfectly. Yeah,
but he misremembers it. The poem goes, a body meet a body coming through the rye, but he remembers it as a body catch a body coming through the rye. And he says that all he can imagine himself wanting to do is, he imagines a big field of rye at the edge of a cliff. and there are children playing in the field. And every so often, one of them will get too close to the edge and he'll catch them before they fall. And he'll be the catcher in the rye. And I think that's such a beautiful image, actually. It really like, because he wants to do something that matters, that has like an impact, that has some sort of like he doesn't want to feel alienated from his labor. Like he wants to feel like the thing that he's doing matters. And I feel like he's surrounded by all these people who basically do nothing.
Right.
Or have no visible impact on the world that's anything but negative.
Yeah, one of the main donors to his school is a guy who is, you know, he runs a morgue, which, like, to be clear, running a morgue. Right, and to be clear, like, I'm not saying running a morgue is not, like, valuable. It doesn't need to be done. But this is a guy who prays for more dead bodies to come to him. This, a little bit different than doing necessary labor of, like, giving people dignified burial, you know. And so he sees that as, like, yeah, that's, like, what we're supposed to go do. We're supposed to be guys who just come back 50 years later to this school that we all hate while we're here and say, wow, these were the good old days. Can you show me where in the bathroom I carved my initials? And he's like, that's the saddest shit I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
And he says, that's phony. That's depressing. Which, like I said earlier, the most repeated words in this are phony and depressed. He says it over and over because everything is phony and everything is depressing. And part of that is being a 16-year-old, but part of that is there is a lot of depressing shit around him and there's a lot of phonies around him.
Yeah.
I
think that the, like you said, a guy who prays for dead bodies, I think is such a good encapsulation of, like, what our society is built on. Like, it 100%. Is built on death. It is built on exploitation. And he can see that. I don't know if he can really hold the idea in his head, but he feels it and he hates it. And it, like, burns him up. And it makes him crazy. It makes him feel like he's a madman.
Because he's endowed with, you know, as limited perhaps as his vocabulary is at this stage in his life, he's endowed with incredible power to describe it and to evoke it for us, right? And in, I mean, this is perhaps, I don't know how relevant this is, but Ossenberger, the morgue dude, right? I mean, Ossi, right? Bone, burger, like bourgeois dude. Like he's literally, his name literally means like bone rich guy. So is that Holden having fun with us? Like is, I don't know. He can describe all these things, but he can't prescribe anything for it. And that's
That's where
he's trapped in.
I also think that like we think of intelligence as being good and being like a positive, and it's arrogant to suggest that you're smarter than the people around you. But being smarter than everybody around you is really alienating and isolating, and it sucks. Like, not that I've ever really been smarter than all of the people around me. Like, that's not really like, but like thinking on a level of that other people aren't is just not an experience that's fun.
Yeah, or having a different analysis, a deeper analysis. Like, that sucks. Like, that he is a guy who loves to read, who is doing really badly in school. Like, and it is not because he's incapable. It's not because he's incapable of writing. It's because he explains later, why are you doing bad in your classes? Well, in rhetoric class, I was really interested in what this one guy has to say, but everyone wants him to follow the formula. Everyone wants him to follow the rubric. And that made me really mad. And he's like, well, what does that have to do with your speech? He's like, I don't know, nothing. I didn't skip class. I just didn't go. And it's like, okay, well, you did. You know, it's like, I think he says that almost. He says, like, I didn't cut class. I just didn't go, or it was something like that, which I love that. And it's like, Holden, you cut class, buddy. But, you know, yeah, it's interesting. And he's absolutely the guy who would like go online and be like, high school isn't for smart people. But like, you know, but there is a truth to that too, you know.
I mean, my little sister dropped out of high school and she's now like a award-winning poet. Like, you don't need to go to high school. Like, there's lots of people I know didn't go to high school.
There is like some truth to that. It is like both cliche and true. You know what I mean? Like, it is both like a thing that it's like, okay, you know, a thing that people spend their time, you know, complaining about online and get through it. But also like there is, it's interesting, like how much of teen angst, where the truth in it lies. And like this book kind of lies in the middle of like a lot of teen angst is correct analysis. And I know I've already said that, but it's remarkable. Like how much of like, you know, through the, I don't know, call it cringe of the way it's expressed, how much like, you know, genuine truth there is in there. But I want to, before we get away from it, I want to make sure that we like properly make sure we fully express this one plot point that we've like completely skipped over. We have not at all mentioned Sally Hayes. And I think that we would be doing doing old Sally a disservice.
The pain in the ass herself.
Because we jumped right to his sister, and Sally actually comes first in the narrative. Mm. Sally Hayes is basically a sort of on again, off again girlfriend he's had. Is that probably the best way to describe her? Mm-hmm. And she's really into theater and movies, and he says it's because she's phony and wants to pretend to like them and doesn't really like them. Is that fair, or is that just him saying that? We don't know. And she's really interested in how she looks, according to him, which he's also kind of interested in how she looks. And they hang out, and like he has moments where he's like, I love you, you're the most beautiful woman in the entire world, I want to marry you. And she's like, absolutely. And then like the next moment he's like, you looked at that actor a little like in a way I didn't like, and I thought that actor was bad, so actually I hate you. Right. And that's kind of their relationship.
He's real needy. Like he needs her to be focused on him. And like she talks to that other guy. Mm-hmm. Like, and like tries to, and he really hates it when she like invites another guy to like come hang out, which I guess is kind of douchey if they're, because like, I don't know, he thinks they're on a date. She might not think they're on a date.
Right.
Like, so her being like, oh, let's all hang out. He really hates that. He's like, he finds it really, he thinks they're making fun of him. And he's very, I really think he comports himself the worst with Sally of basically everybody.
I agree.
He's not a very good, he's kind of a dick to her.
It's funny, in the Wikipedia, when it describes the plot, it says, when Holden begins ranting about society and frightens Sally. that is kind of how they're like, interaction ends, because they go ice skating and he's like, she thought she looked so cute in that outfit, and she looked really cute in that outfit. That was awesome.
He wants to connect with her on a level that she doesn't want to connect with him on. She's like, bro, this is a Wendy's, like, we are just hanging out, please be normal.
And he also, like, they're watching a theater show, and he's like, he's like, it's good in every, like, he's like, it's good in all the ways, but I can't stop imagining these guys rehearsing the show. And that makes me hate it. And I'm like, a little postmodernist.
Yeah,
like,
I know. It's so like, I don't know, Holden has the energy of like one of those kids who only listens to metal. Mm-hmm. Like, he just has such, like, he was, I don't know. He's going to love the Beatniks. Just give it 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
You'll be fine.
He'll find something he likes.
Yeah.
Josh, what did you think of these parts?
I mean, it's he's somebody who has decided that what he's consuming is insipid, because he hasn't really looked too far beyond it, but he hasn't formed a frame of reference for precisely why. He just knows that it's bad. And I mean, indeed, you know, it's something that he doesn't give up on. Cause like he calls up her house later on when it's like 2 a.m. and he's drunk off his ass. And, you know, cause this is one thing that he's retreating to, mm-hmm. which is, again, it's again, I don't necessarily get malice from it. I just get misdirectedness. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting how much he talks about how much he hates the movies. I do think it's very interesting that this is the Hays Code era. Right. So there is a phoniness to movies that he is picking up on, like a government-enforced phoniness. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting. This book feels so modern, like I said earlier. And I think it's because, like, I haven't read a ton of books from this era, but I have seen a lot of movies. So they feel dated in a way this book doesn't, because this book is not sanitized by the Hays Code.
No, this book is not written like most books in the 1950s either. I'll agree. Like, even books I really like, they just read very differently. And this book, you're right. Like, you know, there's some lingo differences, and there's like some moments where it's like, okay, if it was written today, he'd have a cell phone. But like, he thinks and talks more like, you know, very similarly. And it's part of that's quite encouraging to me, right? Because it's like, oh, thing, people don't really change. And I like that. Yeah. That makes me happy.
Yeah, it's really only the slang that dates it.
Yeah. And I do love the slang. It's very charming.
Yeah, I mean, it's not your Clockwork Orange at all, right? It's not an invented language.
No.
Yeah, there's nothing of the Nad Sat about it, right?
He talks normal.
Yeah, you could pick it. You could pick it up in this day and age, as we did, and understand it completely.
No, there were kids in my high school that were like trying really hard to be like hipsters, and like that's how they talked. Like they've just used old, like you could be that at a high school.
Swell,
old, yeah, funky,
old sport. Hates, yeah, old sport.
Calling he loves Great Gatsby. Old. He loves Great Gatsby.
Yeah, he does like the Great Gatsby. Mm. He's like, oh, Gatsby, he killed me.
Mm. He kills me, man.
I also
me
and like Gatsby. The Great Gatsby. I agree.
It's true. It's
yeah. True. I mean, at heart, he meets the nuns at one point, and like he has that. The whole digression on charity. You know, he hates it if he's eating bacon and eggs or something and somebody else is only eating toast and coffee. You know, mm-hmm. he has some idea that, you know, there's a performativeness to charity, how it needs an underclass to continue to exist. Mm-hmm. Like he has a critique of his bourgeois background and the greater system it exists within without necessarily knowing what to do about it. And that depresses the hell out of him.
Yeah, he has a lot of cash in his pocket and he's like, I'm just going to give it all to these nuns. Like,
yeah, they won't take it all.
Yeah.
He wants to give them all his money and they won't take it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He really likes the nuns. Like he doesn't really have anything bad to say about them, except that their suitcases are a little cheap, which
that's
bothers
true.
Him. I think that's why he goes on the suitcase digression. He sees their suitcases.
It also is slightly connected to his God digression, which is one of my favorite parts of the book. If I can, I want to read that too, because it is so funny to me.
He's got a couple, because like he says early on, and I don't know how serious he is about it, that he wants that, you know, hey, how do you join a monastery? You know,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Like, am I going to join the wrong monastery? The monks are all going to be dumbasses.
Yeah, and later on, he mentions like every Catholic has to know if you're Catholic or not. He also says that.
Which
but
is
no,
true.
I liked this quite a bit. Where he was like, he said he felt like praying, but then he says, "But I couldn't do it. I can't always pray when I feel like it. In the first place, I'm sort of an atheist. I like Jesus and all, but I don't care too much for most of the other stuff in the Bible. Take the disciples, for instance. They annoy the hell out of me. If you want to know the truth, they were all right after Jesus was dead and all, but while he was alive, they were about as much use to him as a hole in the head. All they did was keep letting him down. I like almost anybody in the Bible better than the disciples. If you want to know the truth, the guy I like best in the Bible next to Jesus was that lunatic and all that lived in the tombs and kept cutting himself with stones. I like him 10 times as much as I like the disciples, that poor bastard. I used to get in quite a few arguments about it when I went to Wooten School, and that boy that lived down the corridor, Arthur Childs, old Childs was a Quaker and all, and he read the Bible all the time, and he was a very nice kid. And I liked him, but I could never see eye to eye with him on a lot of stuff in the Bible, especially the disciples. He kept telling me if I didn't like the disciples and I didn't like Jesus and all. He said that because Jesus picked the disciples, you were supposed to like him. And I said I knew he picked them, but that he picked them at random. And I said he didn't have time to go around analyzing everybody. I said I wasn't blaming Jesus or anything. It wasn't his fault that he didn't have any time. I remember I asked old Childs if he thought Judas, the one that betrayed Jesus and all, went to hell after he committed suicide. Childs said certainly. That's exactly where I disagreed with him. I said I'd bet $1,000 that Jesus never sent old Judas to hell. I still would, too, if I had $1,000. I think any one of the disciples would have sent him to hell, and all, and fast, too. But I'll bet anything that Jesus didn't do it. And I love that because it's like his like random thoughts and his way of thinking and him like criticizing the institutions he comes from without completely breaking from them, because he's like, wait a second, I like this Jesus guy. And also I like that he very closely read, because the guy who cuts himself with stones like shows up for like a few verses. Like it's a very small character in the book of, I think, Matthew. And then he like notes like Judas and like, oh, where's like the fate of souls when they commit suicide and like things like that. And he's like, oh, old Jesus wouldn't send him. You would, but you wouldn't. And I think hell's unfair. And he's like doing his like empathy thing with his criticism, with him being like a shitty little like wannabe atheist that can't be an atheist. It's very endearing. I quite like it.
Yeah, I like it too. Mm-hmm. I think he makes a good point.
No, he's
I mean,
he's correct.
If you read the Bible, Jesus is pretty chill.
Yeah.
Like,
and the disciples
cool
kind of suck. The disciples are pretty useless for most of it. It's true.
All they do is go around denying him 3 times, whatever.
Always doing that and betraying him. Holden decides that he needs some intelligent conversation. So he calls up a friend that he has said multiple times is annoying and he doesn't like. And now he's calling him up and he's talking about Carl Luce. This is an older friend of his that he, you know, went to a previous school with. And Carl is a guy that is always apparently seeing people and identifying them as being gay. They call them flits.
I've never heard flit before.
That's the first time.
The funny thing is he says lesbian. He says lesbian for women and flits for men.
I kind of love it.
I'm kind of with it. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't really sound like a slur.
It's not that mean.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not going to, like, after this, there's going to be like some old, like gay elder who's like, that's the worst word you can use. Like, I'm hoping that's not what I'm going to get hit with, but no, I'm happy to call myself a flit. Yeah. I can be a flit.
Yeah.
You're a guy, you know, like there's nothing derogatory about it that I am aware of.
I mean, he's obviously, you know, using some like homophobic, whatever. There's no doubt here because that is,
right, but he's not
six. Yeah, sorry.
He's not more homophobic than he is like anti anything else.
Oh,
like,
no.
He hates everybody.
Yeah, no, he's at least as scared of straight sex as he is of gay sex. Like,
oh,
that's
for sure.
But he goes and meets Carl, and he's like, and you mentioned it earlier, but Carl Illouse is like a guy. He's like, yeah, this guy's always talking about sex. And then he goes and he's like, hey, Carl, how's your sex life?
Yeah.
As soon as he walks in, he's like, seen any women, Carl? You know, and Carl's like, can we talk about anything else? And he's like, no, actually, we're gonna keep talking about this. And he gets really drunk in this part. Like, he just keeps drinking because he's finally found a bar that's gonna just keep selling him stuff. And he's getting absolutely destroyed. And he's saying throughout, you know, I'm one of those guys that you'll never even know when he's drunk. Like, you'll never, like, I drink my liquor. I drink it so straight. I'm like, you can't even tell. And he's just like increasingly devolving and like telling people he's 80 years old. And like, and then, yeah. And then you have this whole part where like, he says, I always think Carl is kind of flitty. Like when I was around Carl, and this is the part that like makes me come around to, and it was discussed earlier that he is like uncomfortable with like heteronormativity. And that's not to say that makes Holden Caulfield necessarily gay, but I will say in a lot of ways, really reminds me as a 16-year-old.
I think there is a very strong queer reading of this book.
Yeah,
for sure.
I think there's certainly something of the demisexual about him, like how he can't really relate to somebody physically unless he like really likes them as a person.
I don't know that would make him. I think in this case, I mean, I get what you're saying, but I think that's not. I think it's just more his like general fear around it, right? And when I'm like doing it, like he even like when he's talking like in like looking at women and stuff, his experience with them, he is just like so much more infatuated with like certain like little gestures and things like that in a way. When I looked online for people's readings of this, there have been like two kind of, you know, queer readings of this, right? One is you can kind of go the joke route. And it's like, of course he is. He's really into outfits and he gets, you know, and he makes a lot of jokes about theater and is super critical and whatever. Of course he's like a gay guy.
He is a little queenie.
He's a little queenie. Yeah, exactly. And then there's the other reading where it's like, well, he's like deeply uncomfortable with heteronormativity. And when he imagines being with a woman in a happy way, it has to be kind of outside the bounds of what is accepted. And he is a guy that like multiple times like comments on other guys, like having really good figures and being interested in them physically and like ways that are kind of in between. And like, you know, is getting kind of gets rough and tumble with some guys a couple times, but calls himself a pacifist. And like, is there something there? And the answer is yes, maybe. It's hard to tell when you're 16 years old. And there's like a lot of things going around. Holden is not cut out for at least what he sees as a proper relationship. Of course.
Heteronormative.
But he's why he's uncomfortable with it is not completely clear, but it's like one of those things that he just may not know for a while, and that's fine. But he can't quite get himself in the right place. I can really relate to that.
I feel like that is such like it's weird because like I'm bisexual, but like whenever I imagined myself as like a wife to a husband, I found it really like, I just viscerally hated it.
Right.
Like just being in a heterosexual marriage was just so like, I could not see it. It was just like impossible to me that I see myself like that. I didn't really notice it, I think, when I read it as a young person, but like reading it now, I was like, wow, I really remember this feeling. And it does strike me as really queer. The way that he like, because, I mean, he definitely likes girls, but I think that, like, just, it feels, I don't know, this is kind of like a, a douchey thing to say, but it feels less gay and more queer, if you know what I mean.
I get what you're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's outside your like typical bounds. I mean, like, mm-hmm. you know, we've said heteronormativity several times, but that's, you know, what we're working with here. He's fine with having a wife if they're like doing this like weird bit where they're pretending to be mute in the woods. You know?
Right. Exactly. Like, right. No, he needs props. He needs costumes.
Yeah.
Like he,
yeah. Yeah. There's a really
deep self-consciousness beneath this self-assuredness. Like he's very tuned in to how other people present themselves. Like, I mean, I'm thinking about halfway through the book when he's describing what he likes and he hates about seeing Laurence Olivier play Hamlet, right? Like, he's like, look, this guy's playing Hamlet as kind of a general and not as the sad, screwed up guy that I read him as. So he's a close reader, A. He has that digression about, you know, how, yeah, he sees, you know, this and that girl, and you figure that they'll grow up and they'll go around with this or that, like, jackass guy, right? And beneath it all, he fits himself to, I mean, you see it in the way that Dee greets Carl Luce, right? He's like, okay, this guy talks about sex a lot, so what am I going to do? I'm going to fit myself to that, right? And so he's constantly asking himself, okay, how have other people constructed themselves? How can I construct myself to fit into this? And wait, am I going to hate what I have constructed myself to fit with this person? So right. he has so many fingers pointing back at himself when he points at other people.
And also, right. I'll just make the point. Mm-hmm. His favorite character in all of fiction is Mercutio. He's a little gay.
Yeah, that's a little fruity. That's definitely a little kind of fruity.
There's some real questions that are raised by that. I don't know what to say. But yeah.
Mercutio, he has that, like, I mean, you know, that character has the sort of the emotional turn of the play, you know, where he's like, oh, you know, he was the comic relief and then he gets killed and he's like, yeah, plague of both your houses, you know, you're going fucking downhill, right? Mm-hmm. Spoiler for a 500-year-old play. Mm-hmm. You know, he has that incisiveness about him that, or he wants to aspire to it.
Absolutely. Do y'all have anything else on this topic before we move on to, well, I mean, we can talk about it with relation to this, but to his trip to his teacher's house.
Yeah.
His other teacher. There's a bookend here, isn't it? Yeah. Like, he goes,
the first
Spencer...
one doesn't really, I didn't really have anything to say about the first one. Like the first, yeah. you mentioned.
The very funny essay he reads.
Sure.
That Holden wrote. We're halfway through the essay. He's like, sorry, that's all I know about the Egyptians. You can flunk me if you want.
That's cool. I like that.
He's honest, you know, mm-hmm. he says he's a liar. And indeed he tells outlandish lies. But I mean, at the end of the day, like, he doesn't stick to them.
Yeah.
That's true. He's not good at sticking to lies. That's true. Mm-hmm. But yeah, right. He goes to meet with one of his professors partially because he doesn't know where to go. And he's just like straight up like, I got to sleep somewhere and I'm running low on money.
And also
he likes this guy. This is his old English professor. This is a professor who is, you know, relatively young, who notably married a woman that's much older than him and much wealthier than him. What's his name, the teacher?
Oh, that's Antolini.
Antolini, yeah.
Right.
And Antolini, and he goes and he says, this guy is a guy that's like always smoking, always drinking. He's a guy that, he says, once he gets old, might even be an alcoholic, which is like kind of a funny way of putting it. Like, you can't be an alcoholic when you're not old.
When you're young, yeah.
Yeah. But he hangs out with this guy and they have a conversation where Antolini kind of goes on this whole thing where he's like, I'm worried that you're headed for a great fall, my friend, you know, and it's interesting.
I think this is the closest that somebody gets to getting what Holden's deal is. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy kind of sees him. Like, I think he diagnoses Holden's problem, but his solution is like, go to college, which mm-hmm. is like, probably what Holden should do. Like, I feel like that if he found a certain group in college, he would do really well. But also, again, Holden can't really express himself to this guy, like, exactly what he's feeling. He tries, but he gets really caught in the weeds like he usually does. He's also, like, just wants to go to sleep.
Well, and the stuff that Antolini says about, like, oh, you know, as you get older, like, you figure out, like, the size of your mind and the ideas that you can try on. And I mean, that is something that Holden, I think, recoils at, right? Because he doesn't want to be content to confine himself to just one or another of these things.
He says that you seem like a guy that will die nobly for an unworthy cause.
The mark, yeah, the mark of the immature man is that he wants to die nobly for a cause, while the mark of a mature man is that he wants to live humbly for one. That's the teacher's philosophy. And Holden is not a guy who lives humbly, much as he expresses a desire to.
Yeah, I think that the teacher, I think, doesn't understand him, but I think that he does kind of come across, like, a couple of things he says about Holden, I think, are pretty incisive. But, like, as we see, like, yeah, Holden has kind of a strange encounter with him.
Yeah, and I don't really know what to make of this. But when he goes to sleep, he wakes up and the professor's just kind of sitting next to him, like stroking his head. And he's, understandably is freaked out by
For
this.
really freaks him out.
And he like flees the house and says, "I'll come back," but he doesn't come back. And it doesn't really say, it doesn't have a part later where it's like it was a misunderstanding, but it doesn't have a part later where it was like, and it was revealed that guy was a creep. It just doesn't really go back there. It doesn't have one part where he says, "That's always happening to me. It happens like it's happened like 20 times." And I was like, "Wait, what the hell?" And then he never addresses that again.
He says that, and, like, Holden does exaggerate a lot. Like, he's like, oh, it's like I must have walked for like 100 miles or whatever. But I don't know, like, the way that he drops it does sound like kind of one of his, like, things that he just alludes to, that you just sort of, I don't know. And he's been to what, 4 prep schools?
That and like how defensive Mr. Antolini gets when Holden reacts. Like, he's like, oh, I was just admiring. You're kind of a strange boy. Like,
It's weird
yeah,
for
it
sure.
was a little weird. Like, if, I don't know.
I would think it was weird, I don't know what like Salinger's doing here. Like, I don't know. If you ask Salinger and like got him to answer, it's like, was Antolini being a predator here in your head? I don't know what he would say. What matters is the perception of Holden in this moment,
Yeah,
you
I
know?
think, I mean, also the guy was, like, really drunk. So, like, but I don't know. Like, to me, it feels, it kind of feels almost like the most cynical part of the book to me, because, like, he has this person that he, like, can turn to and that sort of understands him, or at least accepts him, and then kind of just ruins it. And, like, it's like even this person, like, this last refuge, is will be taken from you. And it kind of is the most cynical moment of the book for me.
And even if we are to read, Mr. Antolini, like, nothing weird about it, right? That doesn't matter because Holden is, I mean, he's poisoned against, as you say, it's cynicism, right? Holden doesn't see anything positive in it, even if it is completely positive.
Even though he kind of starts rationalizing it, he was like, you know, it probably wasn't Flitty, and even if it was, like, who cares? It's, like, not a big deal. He was just touching my head. He was really nice to me and stuff like that. So he starts trying to rationalize it, but yeah, and then he just kind of keeps going downhill from there, like, 'cause he's out in the cold and he's, like, hasn't slept.
Notably, like, Antolini, he mentions, is the guy who, like, the person that Holden knew who was brutalized by that group of kids and then jumped from the window. Like, he mentions that Mr. Antolini was the one who came and got him, right? So,
Who
like,
picked up the corpse? Nobody else would touch it.
And to it's striking that, Antolini is able to be there in that capacity and still go on and, entertain guests at his, swanky house at what and whatnot. And if I'm Holden Caulfield and I know that about him and I'm meeting him in this moment now, I'm thinking, how are you not obsessed with this? How are you not still carrying around the trauma of that child dying in your arms? And I mean, part I think part of being Holden Caulfield later in life is thinking to yourself, I am still carrying that trauma, and I'm carrying a whole bunch of other things that I can also compartmentalize.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, like, in a way, also, I think that Antolini is maybe, like, a projection of a possible future Holden, because I can see Holden, like, living kind of unusual. Like, I don't know, the implication of a guy living with a much older woman who's wealthy. I don't know if he was supposed to come across as gay. I don't know.
Well, he straight up, I mean, Holden charms the hell out of an older woman earlier in the book.
Yeah, exactly.
The first two chapters. So, like, it's well in Holden's power.
Also, I could see Holden very innocently sitting there stroking somebody's head.
Yeah.
Like, sort of weirdly without, it being weird at all.
Yeah.
So,
it's one of those things, like, you know, gun to my head, I would say Salinger intends this to be a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that that's the case. And I'm not like comfortable saying that. But what we said is, what matters though is Holden feels betrayed by this guy that's supposed to understand him.
Right. I also kind of would want to stroke Holden on the head.
Different. It's like, just little sleep. Guy.
Yeah.
Just sleep, little guy. Sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Holden flees. He's already been out in the cold a lot. He's been drinking like an insane amount. You know, I don't really know. His diet has not been good. He's already like
he's barely
sickly
been
little
eating.
Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like when he was eating eggs and toast, he felt bad about it because other people weren't. Like
hasn't
he,
been sleeping.
Yeah. So
oh, yeah.
He's just sick and he feels pneumonia and a fever coming on.
The diarrhea that he mentions, you know, because he's just on like breakfast food and alcohol
and booze and when places won't serve him alcohol as much like Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
I got really sick at one point when I went to my friend's Halloween party, not because I had drank too much, but because I had barely eaten that day, but I had drank a shitload of coffee.
Oh, yeah.
So like just having the wrong stuff inside you can enormously mess you up.
Yeah. And in many ways, this book is about a guy with a lot of bad stuff inside him that messes him up. You know who else?
Verbal diarrhea.
You know who else? Holden Caulfield. Yeah, no, Holden then decides
He's holding a lot of that stuff inside.
Oh my God.
I knew.
Oh, I love also the name Holden Caulfield is such a rich kid name. It's just like upper class.
Holden Caulfield, yeah. He at this point decides I'm running away. I'm going to pretend to be mute and deaf so I don't have to talk to anyone. I'm going to work as a gas station attendant and I'll build a cabin.
Right.
And so he's like, I'm going to say bye to my sister. He goes to her school, and at her school, he sees "fuck you" written on the wall, and it makes him really mad.
He gets so mad about it.
He's so mad. He's like, kids shouldn't have to know what that word means. Kids should not have to know what that word means. And like, he's like 16. He's not that much older than his sister. And it's like a sweet impulse. And he like scrubs it off the wall, and he sees it again. He's like, this one's carved. And he says, you could scrub all the "fuck yous" off the wall for your entire life, and you wouldn't even get half of them by the time you're dead. He goes,
In a million years, you couldn't do it.
Yeah. He says, I guarantee you, when I'm a corpse, when I have a tombstone, someone's going to scrawl "fuck you" on my tombstone. And that makes me so mad. And then he has a diatribe about how he doesn't like tombstones and being buried and please just chuck me in the water. And then has a really sad part about how he had to leave his brother while it was raining and it rained on his stomach. And that made me so sad.
Oh, yeah. The part about how, like thinking about leaving him in the funeral and in the graveyard. Yeah, he's really, and it's only been like 3 years since his brother died.
Oh, yeah.
So he's like real torn, like still has not processed it. And you can tell his parents haven't really helped him process it. They've just sent him to prep school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He even said his mom hasn't processed it. His mom is just fundamentally different person now. Yeah. His body has not fully processed it. He can't make a full fist with one of his hands because he punched glass so hard after his brother's death. But notably his sister, and it's a very, you know, sweet moment of his sister saying, well, I'm just going to run away with you, which is, you know, it's kind of a classic, you know, kind of scene, and he's like, well, I'm not gonna run away.
Yeah,
you know, and they're together
to school.
Yeah. And then he lets, and she's mad at him, but they stay together, and I very sweet, you know, her being mad at him but following on the other side of the road. And for a moment here I was like, there better not be some like her getting hit by a truck or something. I'd be so mad.
No,
like, I had a moment
that would
like,
be phony. He would never,
I agree,
would never do that.
It would be phony, and that's what I was worried, they were gonna like fumble it in the last 10 pages. Because I knew some people didn't like this book, and I was worried it was that. No, it turns out that these people are just wrong.
Because, well, and that's the thing, like, it would validate I mean, it would validate so many, like, I mean, I'm not going to say Holden Caulfield's a narcissist. He's as much a narcissist, I think, as anybody is at that age. But, like, I mean, that would validate the thesis of, you know, I'm the only one who is feeling this way. I am uniquely sad and I am uniquely put upon by the world, right? Yeah. You know, to have that one last light in his life snuffed out. Just
yeah, no, I'm glad it doesn't. Yeah. In fact, it gets brighter because they go to the zoo and then she rides the carousel and it's very sweet. And then he's like, she's reaching for the ring. And it's important that a kid gets to reach for the ring. And even if they fall off, it's important that they try and reach for it. And, you know, it's not a subtle metaphor, but it's a good metaphor. It's him, you know.
Right. He's just sitting and he's watching her while he's sitting in the rain, like watching her do this. Mm-hmm. And he feels very jaded and stuff about it. But I don't know. I think that's a really beautiful scene. And it's like almost the last scene before he's like, yeah, anyway, then after that I was sick and I had to come here and like calm down after, because you kind of get the idea that they like sent him to the farm or something. Yeah. He like went to like,
well, I think they sent him out to be with his brother, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. And his brother lives out on the West Coast. And he always is like, my brother's stupid because he writes movies and movies are bad.
He explicitly refers to his brother DB as a prostitute for going out to Hollywood.
He's prostituting himself in Hollywood. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. And it doesn't end in very any, like, with much of a fanfare at all. Like, there's no, like, big moment. He doesn't really learn anything. Well, I mean, he does sort of, but he's not, I don't know. It's sort of very, like, kind of subsides. It doesn't really have a climax. Mm-hmm. I'd say the climax is the scene with, Mr.
Antolini.
Yeah, Antolini. I'd say that was probably the closest this book comes to having a climax. But
probably so, yeah. If you were reading it and you did not have any idea of its page count, like you just were somehow disguised from knowing that, you would probably be like, you know, not think you're close to the end, probably, when you get to chapter 25.
And then you'd be like, oh, did I download like an incomplete text of this off of, yeah, exactly.
And it's not to say that it's a you know, tonally incomplete book. I think it goes through a complete arc. It goes through the weekend. It goes through him realizing, okay, I'm gonna stay. That is that is an ending, you know, in and of itself. But it isn't a full ending. This is a few days in the life of this kid that is going to continue to carry these things. Nothing is really, I won't say nothing is resolved, but there is a lot of unresolved shit in there. He's still got a lot to figure out. And I think the only thing he really comes to is that it's okay and he's gonna, that he hasn't figured it out yet. And he has this moment here at the end where he's just happy in the rain and gets to have a moment of just pure unbridled happiness that isn't really tied to something that is immediately going to let him down in the next 5 seconds. Right. And it's something that's genuinely like good and not phony. And I think that's, you know, getting wet in the rain while your sister rides a beat up horse on a carousel. He gets to have this moment of authenticity. And then he says at the very end, in like the very last paragraph, he says he feels bad that he told everyone about this story. And he says, I sort of miss everybody I told about, even old Stradlater and Ackley, for instance. I think I even miss that goddamn Maurice. It's funny. Don't ever tell anybody anything. If you do, you start missing everybody. And that's an interesting place to end it on, because he's, you know, being nostalgic and he's just being himself. But I don't know. I wonder what y'all think of that ending. Why is that? Why is that where it closes out on? Do you have thoughts on that?
I kind of think that it, I don't know. It kind of has this unity to it that he's like, he starts the book by standing on the hill and looking down at his prep school. And I looked at it trying to feel some sort of goodbye or something. And he's like, he says he doesn't want to finish anything without like getting a goodbye from it. So I feel like that it's sort of like him thinking back on all these people and missing them. And also like, just kind of like knowing that he has people worth missing, I think is good for Holden. Like that there are people that he values in his life, even though he might not be aware of it.
It reminds me of being in high school and I was breaking up with this girl and she said, and I'm not, you know, making fun of her for this, it's funny and abstract, but she said, well, we have to have a good last kiss. Like she's had this idea that there has to be a good last kiss, right? Our last kiss can't have been just one, some random, whatever.
Right.
And that feels very much like a Holden thing, but this idea of like him saying like, well, I have to have a proper goodbye. And then it's like, well, then well, shoot, I had a proper missed goodbye and now I'm sad about it. That's not what I wanted, you know? And
right.
He's like, I processed my feelings and now I have to feel them. You know, it's a very 16-year-old thing, but it's a very true thing. It's like, well, I want to have closure, but closure also means I have to experience the thing. Like, I want the experience of moving on without the pain that entails. And I thought that was interesting, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not always as clean as all that, you know. Like, Holden notices things about people. He pays attention to people, you know. I mean, one of my favorite little details in the book is that Jane Gallagher, you know, the girl that he, not his one-itis necessarily, but like, you know, just the girl that he remembers fondly. Like, she
the girl
would
next
play,
door, yeah.
Yeah, the girl next door, you know, she would play checkers and she would leave all her kings in the back row, right? Yeah. She wouldn't do anything with them. Like, she just liked the way that the kings looked back there, you know? Strategically, was it optimal? No. But like, it's something cute and unique about her that, you know, that sticks with him.
Right.
And to leave that sort of thing behind is, I mean, he even misses the assholes in his life, right? Not because of who they were, but because of, you know, but because of what they represented to him, but because of what they shared, and because of how, I mean, because of how they exchange, you know, their fights, their conversations, their experiences, you know, that sort of dialectic that you get where you genuinely don't know if you're going to be rooming with an asshole or somebody who's just saying, yeah, he's okay.
Right. You know,
yeah. He misses navigating that sort of controlled unpredictability in his life. And I mean, he strikes me as somebody who stresses a great deal about how the hell he's going to meet people after prep school, after college,
yeah,
you know, because you have to find some sort of common ground with somebody. And his big worry, I think, is that it's going to be the same common ground as everybody else.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm rooting for him.
I am. And for what it's worth, he's pretty good at starting up random conversations. And he,
right.
And I think if he starts up random conversations, not at 3 a.m. blasted drunk, he'll have a better time making friends. So once he learns that, he's going to be just fine.
Right. Walk up to a girl at the bar. Where were you in Pearl Harbor?
Oh, my God. Yes, he will. He'll say it was me. I was riding the atomic bomb, which, right. You know, I mentioned it earlier, but he literally says, he's like, I'm glad we have the atomic bomb so I can ride it. And it's like, man, he literally made a reference to Dr. Strangelove decades before it came out. What do you know? That's kind of the plot of the book. It's not particularly long. It's, I think, about 70,000 words. It's not like a super long novel. I think it's the right length. I think if there was a lot more plot in here and characters and whatever, I think a lot of it would get lost. I just don't think there's time for it.
Yeah.
I really, and to even get in other people's heads, I think would have been, to a greater extent than it does, I think would have been a mistake. Ultimately, I think this is a really beautiful book.
Yeah.
It is one of the best books I've ever read about being this age, being like a teenager, being someone who is transitioning from one place of life to the next, someone who is fed up with the world around them, but does not have this proper language. This, you know, who knows? Maybe this kid goes on and becomes a Marxist and is like, I'll make the argument for why capitalism, X, whatever. Or maybe not, you know, maybe he completely loses it. Maybe he becomes a religious nut. Maybe he just does become a phony. I don't know. Or at what he would call a phony. But he is at this point in his life where he has the critique and he is smart enough to see, you know, the cracks in things, as you said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's something like really beautiful and, you know, obviously cringeworthy in moments and uncomfortable. And he is just all of it. And the book is brutally honest. And I laughed my head off and I really, really love this book. And
yeah.
It's awesome.
I think it's arguably, I don't know. I mean, I could just be completely making this up, but like maybe the first young adult novel in a way, like,
maybe.
Like, I don't know. It just feels like something that was written for young people,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really, I don't know. I can't think of, I mean, I guess like, you know, Boyzone magazines and stuff like that, you know, but it really feels like, yeah, a young adult novel.
Yeah. Maybe. I mean, there's The 17th Summer by Maureen Daly, which like is often called like the first young adult novel. But in the sense, but I've also not read that, so I don't actually know much about it. I just know, like, trivia, when people say the first young adult novel, it's The 17th Summer. Joss, maybe we should add it to the list. I don't know.
Who wrote it again?
That's Maureen Daly, I think. I might not even be saying it right. I'm just, but regardless,
he knows. Y'all are correct. You know, he knows just enough about the world and his environment, right, to conclude that it's unequal to the task of allowing you to process the trauma that it inflicts on you and the people around you. You know, he doesn't know enough to interrogate that yet, or to prescribe anything for it. But he's just waking up to that fundamental sort of brokenness. I am also quite glad that it doesn't really get into anybody else's heads, because it's not supposed to, because he is, for all he knows, alone in this, even though he's anecdotally, but I think also objectively, not alone in this.
You could very easily have like a section where he just is like, thinks of the concept of solipsism and plays with it for a little while. That would fit very well in this. If he's like, wait, what if I'm the only like perceptive thing in the universe? And then he's like, wait, that's dumb.
Because I'm sure he'll get there.
Yeah, he will. But then he'd be like, that's dumb, because the ducks clearly have feelings. And then be his thing.
Well, and all the more reason that the trajectory of Salinger himself kind of turns me off, because Salinger essentially, I mean, he doesn't go, deaf mute. Like, he still engages with people enough to, marry and divorce them and get into weird,
letter writing relationships.
Yeah. Letter writing relationships. Salinger withdraws from the world in the way that Holden considers doing, but I think ultimately we wouldn't want that for him. I think ultimately he wouldn't make that decision for himself. And it's the sort of cop-out that I think Holden himself would describe as phony.
I feel like in a way that Holden is almost like a alternate self that Salinger wrote for himself who didn't go to war.
Sure.
Because Holden is like, it takes place in like 1951, I think. Early 50s, right after the war. So I don't know, that's kind of just me like spitballing, but just sort of this like dreamed up other version of a person who didn't have his life like cut off at the knees like Salinger did, in a way that like we could never relate to.
I agree. He says in it Holden says, I would never go to war. I mean, I was joking about the atomic bomb line earlier, but it comes from the same thing where he says, if I was in war, I would want to die immediately. Right. And that's, this character is, of course, conceived before he goes to World War II, but this book is written afterwards. This short story was written as a pre-war jitters, but this is written as an afterwards of a guy who has no pre-war jitters. It's after the war, and he would never touch war with a 10-foot pole. And I think you're right. It's semi-autobiographical, but it is this other direction that I think, Salinger maybe wishes he could have gone. And, it's hard to, he says it's hard to get the smell of, burning human bodies out of your nose. And, I have that, for all his mistakes, I obviously have that deep sympathy for Salinger, because holy shit, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's also like, it is that makes Caulfield's decision in this time of his life, that Salinger is making a different decision, so interesting, I guess.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a great point. Thank you for raising that, because that's a whole nother level of complexity and heaviness to this, I would say.
Yeah. No. I mean, it is an extremely light read
for
a book with so much complexity in it. It's very breezy.
Oh, yeah. No, I think didn't listen to an audiobook, but I think you could. I can imagine an audiobook of this would be pretty good. Some books don't. But if you had a really good voice actor, I think you could have a pretty fun audiobook.
Go ahead.
Oh, there were a bunch of actors who like really, really wanted to adapt this. Like, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio wanted it, like Jerry Lewis really got into the idea of it, even though he was like 30 when he read the book. Fucking like John Cusack, like one of his great regrets was aging out of the age range to play Holden Caulfield.
It would be a good movie. Like, I feel like that there's so much to it that is so interior. Mm-hmm. And I, there are lots of books that are very interior that can be made into movies, but there's just something about the voice of this book that is so integral to it mm-hmm. that wouldn't work in a movie.
I'm inclined to agree. I think there could be, and I don't know, and I wouldn't be the one to write it. I could see an effective stage adaptation working better than a movie, but even mm-hmm. then it's like, because like the level of presentness and just this guy talking and talking, like it would need to be centered around this guy talking and talking and talking.
Right. Or a video game.
Honestly.
But you know, just kind of, I don't know, because just like the sort of like interiority you can get to in a video game
sure.
that like you can't in a lot of other things. But like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It drives me nuts how like hated this book is. It's mm-hmm. so weird. It doesn't deserve it at all. Mm-hmm. Like I know it gets kind of like, oh, just, you know, 300 pages of a white guy whining, which I feel like is so reductive. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, I mean, it's like, sure. Okay. Yes. But like most books, classic books are white guys whining. Let's be real.
Yeah. Common denominator, but then what do you do with that? Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I feel like that this book has a lot to offer if you're willing to like look past the sort of like the things that you've seen Twitter threads talking about how bad it is.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's no accounting for taste, but if you want to talk about just the actual substance of it, the substantive critiques I've seen have not really been correct or accurate or come in a way that I think are fair. And I'm sure there are, you know, more advanced critiques than the ones I have been exposed to, but for the most part, it has just kind of seemed like a caricature of what it is. And this is a lot, you know, there's a lot more soul to this, and there's a lot more of just rawness, and it is just very, very silly for most of it. It's very silly and messy, and it's just what it is. And I am, it was an absolute delight to read it, and I really appreciate you recommending us pick it up.
Yeah, yeah, seconded. Thank you so much, like, for turning us on to this.
Yeah. Sure. Well, folks, as we wrap up here, do y'all have any final thoughts on The Catcher in the Rye?
I think that it's, you know, nobody wants to hear this when they're Holden's age. And I don't know if you have any listeners who are Holden's age, but I don't know. I think that this thing that Holden feels is a completely universal human experience of feeling like you are the only one to ever feel that way. And that, the world is against you or doesn't understand you or is bleak, but and in a lot of ways that Holden is right about the world. The world is pretty bad, but there are like little glimmers of goodness in the world. And I think that that comes through in these little moments where he like comes across people that matter to him or things that intrigue him, like the ducks or your sister grabbing for a ring on a carousel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's good to keep in mind, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, whence the importance of, you know, seeking other people out, of, you know, sharing these stories of, you know, what was traumatic in your life and also what was beautiful in your life, because there are common denominators in the former that, you know, if enough people get together and start talking about that, they can start coming up with solutions collectively, you know,
exactly.
through various forms of struggle, you know. And as for the latter, you know, the beautiful things, I mean, hey, you know, we all want to hear about, you know, this cute girl that you liked, the stacked kings and checkers, you know, because it's unique, you know, it's weird, it's quirky, and it's the sort of thing that sticks out to you that you don't know why it does, but you're glad it does, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, Aisha, I really appreciate you coming on. Do you have, you know, anything that you would like to plug, tell our listeners, promote, anything like that?
Not really. I just work full time on this game that hasn't been announced yet, so I can't
Fair
plug
enough.
It yet. So
no social shelf exclusives today. No, nothing
yeah,
like that.
You can follow me. I'm on Blue Sky, Aisha Ufara. It's just my name. I have a Twitter or an X, but it is a hellscape there recently, so I have not been on there. So you probably won't catch me there, but...
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, we really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, what we are going to start doing is we're going to start telling folks a little ahead of time what we're going to be reading so that people can Some people seem to want to try and read along with us. So next week we will be reading The Ballad of Black Tom, I believe.
By Victor Laval, yes.
Yes, the short story.
A retelling, a reinterpretation, essentially, of H.P. Lovecraft's The Horror at Red Hook.
Yes.
So one of his most racist stories, from a more intriguing perspective.
Mm. Interesting.
And the week after that, did we say the Crab Ship Cannery for the week after that?
The Crab Cannery Ship by Takaji Kobayashi.
Gotcha. So, you know, keep that in mind if anyone's interested in reading along. We are going to try and do less part one, part twos, because, you know, just trying to put out more stuff, but we'll be doing more short stories, more maybe covering some fan fictions, you know. Well, nothing as good as My Immortal, because that's probably the best thing we'll ever cover on the show.
Impossible
to peak, but yeah.
Maybe, well, maybe 30 H's can rival it.
Something along those lines. Well, it's, folks, it's been fun. Joss, do you have an episode specific sign off for us on this one?
You know, go out, catch some bodies.
Catch the rye.
Catch the rye. Mm-hmm.
See everybody.
Thank you, guys.